very deeply, and people on the Clapham Omnibus care not a jot, but I can tell you who you shouldn't trust for insights into what is going on at the corporation. Anybody on the payroll of media organisations dedicated to the destruction of the BBC, best understood as the ones that billionaires have bought in order to try to influence the news agenda. So, bye-bye Rupert Murdoch, bye-bye Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, and various other useful idiots who sail in them.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the chairman of the BBC is expected to apologise for the way a speech by Donald Trump was edited in a Panorama documentary. Director General Tim Davey has resigned following claims two clips were put together to show the president encouraging the US Capitol riots. Chief Executive of BBC News, Deborah Turnis, has also stepped down. She spoke to reporters this morning.
I stepped down over the weekend because the buck stops with me. But I'd like to make one thing very clear. BBC News is not institutionally biased. Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
The White House has welcomed their resignations. New centres are being set up across the country to help veterans with healthcare, housing and jobs. £27 million of funding is being made available by the government. The Veterans Minister, Louise Santer-Jones, has set out the scheme.
One thing that I hear all the time from veterans is, I've got this problem, I'm not sure where to go, where can I go to get support? And what Valour is about addressing that. So it'll be a physical location where somebody can go in, have a cup of tea, talk about the issues that they're facing and be signposted to all the support that is out there to help them.
The longest government shutdown in American history could be coming to an end. Domestic flights have been affected and government workers have not been paid for the last 40 days. Democrats have agreed to support Republican plans, but there still needs to be another vote. The latest climate talks will get underway in Brazil this week as world leaders meet on the edge of the Amazon rainforest. Leaders from the world's biggest polluters, the US, China and India, won't be at the COP30 climate summit though. And an initiative from the Prince of Wales will join a charity set up by former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The Homewards programme will collaborate with the Multibank to furnish 250 homes around the UK. It will initially operate across six flagship locations, including Aberdeen, Sheffield and Newport. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 76 points at 97.58. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 14. LBC weather, a cloudy start for most of the UK with some dry and bright spells later. Feeling mild with highs of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about. And to use a favorite term that all of you people really came up with, we will stop the steal. Today, I will lay out just some of the evidence proving that we won this election and we won it by a landslide. This was not a close election. You know, I say sometimes jokingly, but there's no joke about it. I've been in two elections. I won them both. And the second one, I won much bigger than the first. Okay.
And what are you going to do about it, Donnie?
As this enormous crowd shows, we have truth and justice on our side. We have a deep and enduring love for America in our hearts. We love our country. We have overwhelming pride in this great country, and we have it deep in our souls. Together, we are determined to defend and preserve government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Our brightest days are before us. Our greatest achievements still wait. I think one of our great achievements will be election security, because nobody until I came along had any idea how corrupt our elections were. And again, most people would stand there at 9 o'clock in the evening and say, I want to thank you very much. And they go off to some other life. But I said, something's wrong here. Something's really wrong. Can't have happened. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Don't take my word for it. Talk to the people who were, of course, convicted of insurrection in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of that speech, during which, of course, during the insurrection, Donald Trump failed signally to intervene, even as his own former vice president, Mike Pence, was subject to what can only be described as a bloodlust. There's still some decent journalists out there covering this kind of issue. And one of the organisations I'd point you to has looked at, count them, 210 defendants from 40 states and the District of Columbia who were charged for their participation in the January the 6th insurrection, all of whom have said in evidence that they were answering Donald Trump's calls when they travelled to Washington and joined the violent attack on the Capitol. So had it come to court, which it would have done had he not won the subsequent election, the 2024 election, the clips you heard involved him lying about the previous election, lying egregiously, shamelessly, lying through his teeth, lying obviously, lying violently, lying in ways that almost redefine the parameters of lying. Conduct so scandalous that it is almost as bad as splicing together two bits of a speech to make him sound even more belligerent than he did already. I clutch my pearls and shiver my timbers. I'll tell you how that happened shortly as well. But 210 defendants considered Trump their leader and believed they were following his lead by joining the insurrection. And the reason why I began with that clip this morning is to remind you why they believed that they were following Trump's lead and indeed joining an insurrection that he inspired and wanted and for which he would have been required to answer in court had he not won the 2024 election. He was impeached for it, but you need a two-thirds majority in the Senate for an impeachment to pass. And they didn't secure, although they secured a majority, they didn't secure a two-thirds majority. And then it's probably worth listening to the last bit, isn't it? Because it is with the fight like hell bit that this bit next was spliced together in an edit room for reasons that I think you have to be supremely dishonest to pretend not to understand. Was it a stupid thing to do? Yes. Was it done as part of a bias or through malevolence? Well, that's a position you can only sustain if you completely ignore what I just played you. And indeed, the entire speech in both tone and content is entirely at odds with this little snippet that follows. But what you do if you are preparing to, already signed up to, the lies that Donald Trump thrives upon and depends upon for political success and political survival is you completely ignore that. You either don't listen to the speech at all and pray that the people you're talking to or the people you're writing for don't listen to it either or don't go back to it either, or you claim that the obvious incitement to insurrection was somehow tempered or leavened by this little phrase here, this little minute of clip here, which is completely at odds with the entirety of the rest of the speech. This, by the way, is balanced journalism, going back to the source, not inviting onto the program somebody who is so far up Trump's bum that you can only see his toes, or somebody who was in line to be made Director General of the BBC by Boris Johnson, who, of course, was Prime Minister when the current Director General, the recently departed Director General, Tim Davey was appointed. And indeed, of course, in Boris Johnson's Downing Street, Dominic Cummings held great sway, a man previously employed by a secretly funded think tank to chiefly dedicate all of his energies to calling for the BBC to be defunded. And of course, over at the BBC, as a non-executive director, you have a man called Sir Robbie Gibb, knighted for services to the Conservative Party by Theresa May, and gliding effortlessly from GBBs, a massively loss-making operation designed to let billionaires set the news agenda in this country, more of which later, over to the BBC, where he immediately started lecturing proper journalists on what impartiality looks like and is known to have intervened in editorial appointments. You want to talk about bias? I'm here for you. You want to talk about insurrection? You need to go back to the facts. And one of the facts is that they didn't need to splice this together. You didn't need to do any mischievous editing in order to make it clear that Donald Trump was inciting an insurrection, because he was, and he did. And if you don't believe the evidence of your own eyes and ears, ask the people that did the insurrection, most of whom, of course, have been pardoned now. Funny that, isn't it? If it had nothing to do with him, why on earth would he be pardoning the people that did it? Anyway, here's the bit that they spliced together, and I'll tell you why. Because sitting in that room, in that edit, in mid to late October of last year, even then, before Donald Trump won the next election, even then, it wouldn't have occurred to anybody in that building that the narrative was going to shift so violently and so far. I don't know if we should put this little splice together, because some people might be claiming this time next year that he didn't actually incite the insurrection. To which the only reasonable response would have been, don't be so stupid. Nobody's ever going to claim that black is white, that up is down, that freedom is slavery, that ignorance is strength. Nobody's ever going to claim any of these. Look, it's a silly edit, but it's an edit made in the context of not contemplating for a moment that British journalists, never mind Donald Trump fanboys and girls, would be queuing up to pretend that his lies were truth, that the election was stolen, that the insurrection was not incited by him, that the, count them, 210 people tracked down by one media organisation or examined by one media organisation, well, an ethics organisation in the United States, didn't express their absolute certainty that they were acting on his say-so. So in that edit, at that moment, it wouldn't have crossed anybody's mind that they'd have to defend themselves against accusations of undermining the idea that he incited an insurrection, because he so obviously did. So why do it? Is the only question left to answer, and that's a question they should be required to answer. It's not a question that involves resignations, or, let's be honest, sackings. And I'll tell you why the sackings happened after I play you the clip, What Got Spliced.
And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women, and we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated. Lawfully slated. I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. Today we will see whether Republicans stand strong for integrity of our elections, but whether or not they stand strong for our country. Our country. Our country has been under siege for a long time, far longer than this four-year period.
And, of course, the reason you play the clips is because the rest is interpretation. You play the clips. You can't listen to that speech without concluding that he incited an insurrection. I mean, it is literally impossible to do so. But we live in a world where the literally impossible has become electorally successful, not least, of course, in the context of the White House. It was a stupid thing to do, but they didn't need to do it. The speech would have delivered all of the evidence that was needed to prove incitement to insurrection, as the Senate concluded, a majority of the Senate concluded, and as the court almost certainly would have done if he hadn't had all charges dropped as a consequence of winning the last election. So I don't know who lines up on the other side, really. I should probably have a look at my inbox. I don't know who lines up on the other side, claiming that he didn't incite an insurrection. So you're calling the 210 people who joined it liars. They say, why did you join it? And they say, because Donald Trump wanted us to. He told us to. Well, what are they, liars? They did it independently. They decided to act upon the ludicrous and deeply dishonest claim that the election had been stolen without any reference to the person making that claim. The lie itself is an incitement to insurrection. You believe in democracy and somebody tells you it has been traduced, then you are being incited if that person is lying. If that person is telling the truth, you're being inspired. Isn't that weird? I hadn't thought of that before. If I tell you something that's not true, for example, about the identity of somebody who's undertaken a terrible crime, and you then go and set fire to buildings containing people who may share some attributes with someone who's committed a terrible crime, I am inciting you. But of course, even if I'm telling the truth about the identity of the culprit, I'm also inciting you, if you take from my words the belief that you should go out and burn buildings down or set fire to buildings. If I lie to you about an election being stolen, I am inciting you. If I tell you the truth about an election being stolen, I'm actually inspiring you. Now, if it was in Russia, for example, and you were casting a sceptical eye over the election results, then you would have a case for inspiring popular revolution, popular revolt. But literally nobody honest, informed, or remotely interested in evidence believes that Donald Trump won the election he claims that he won against Joe Biden. It is the mother of all lies. It's the lie upon which everything else rests and all else follows, which is why he has to continue working to inflate it and to and endorse it. So we're now contemplating the semantic possibility of fighting peacefully, which of course is just enough camouflage for people to pretend that they didn't hear what they heard, and that the hundreds of insurrectionists that day, including seditionists, of course, like the Proud Boys and other organizations, didn't hear what you heard. And, you know, I'm still surprised by the effort people put into pretending they didn't hear what they just heard. I'm surprised when my father's old paper does it, the Daily Telegraph. More outraged, apparently, by a stupid splice in the edit suite than by the leader of the free world existing or achieving power with lies, with unparalleled, unprecedented lies, with disgusting and hideous lies. It makes the stuff about eating dogs and cats look positively tame. But his entire political project is based on lies, you know. And he can't help himself. You'd have thought, having been re-elected, he might have come just, well, let's never mention that business again when I pretended that I'd won. But he can't help himself. That's the narcissism coming up against the pathology. But I don't know how much effort it takes. How much effort does it take to pretend that a one-hour speech inciting violence is somehow defused or undermined by a one-minute clip where he talks about the country being under siege, he talks about standing strong for our country, he talks about the elections having been stolen, he talks about making your voices heard, and he uses the word peacefully once, having used the word fight twice in a single sentence. We will never concede. If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. So it's not even up for debate. And that's the problem. The BBC would now debate it. Now it would. Last year it wouldn't have done, which is how they ended up making the stupid edit. Last year it wasn't debatable. Of course he incited an insurrection. Nobody pretends otherwise. Of course he lied about winning in 2020. Nobody pretends otherwise except him and his mad supporters. But that's the way it works. That's the way these things unfold, is that you tell a lie often enough and loud enough, and eventually the pendulum starts swinging. And either people who know it's a lie stop caring enough, or people who don't really know for sure that it's a lie start believing that it isn't. And we're witnessing it now, being bizarrely sponsored and promoted by UK media outlets that seem to be celebrating the interference in British democracy of a foreign leader. I would not be surprised if the BBC seat in the press room goes to GBeebies in the next week or two. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm exaggerating. We'll check in with Simon Marks later to see what he thinks about it all. But I would not be surprised if they use this as a pretext to keep the BBC out of the briefing, just as they're keeping all half-decent American journalists out of the press briefings and confining the congregation entirely to people who are fully paid-up members of this ludicrous fan club. A fan club that only exists to lie. To lie about the insurrection and to lie about the 2020 election result. Isn't that extraordinary? It was genuinely extraordinary. 19 minutes after 10 is the time. I've got a lot more to tell you. I want to tell you a little bit more about the very deliberate, concerted attempts over decades to destroy the BBC, to render it, because it is not, it does not exist, to do the bidding of the billionaire that owns it, like GB News does, like The Spectator does, like The Daily Mail does. It does not exist to do the bidding of the millionaire that owns it, like The Times does these days, most of the time, like The Sun does. It does not exist to do the bidding of the billionaire that owns it. And if you don't understand the peril of that simple sentence, have a look at who was sitting behind Donald Trump at the inauguration. Spoiler alert, the billionaires who control public discourse in the United States of America, whether by buying newspapers or owning social media platforms. And, of course, in Elon Musk's case, turning it into a racist, far-right, Trump-supporting sewer. So you could sit here on a morning like this and think, why are they so exercised by the BBC? Why do they care so much? Why are they turning this relative molehill into an enormous mountain? And the answer is, they can't. They can't help themselves. Anybody not doing the bidding of that cabal, or whatever you want to call it, that in this case, Trump-supporting corruptocracy, anybody in a position to stand up to it, to challenge it, to shine a little bit of light into it. Here's my next guest, Nigel Farage. What? On what possible planet is he a valid contributor to a conversation about this? He's on the BBC more than David Dimbleby was in his Question Time days. And what the BBC don't realise is that these people want their destruction. And they think that by feeding them or tickling them or appeasing them, they'll somehow be able to see off the threat. But it's an existential threat, because they hate any media outlet that doesn't doff cap, tug forelock and do what they want. It's extraordinary when you see it in such simple and clear terms. It's absolutely extraordinary. What's your problem with the BBC? Most people think it leans the wrong way. Most people on the left think it's horribly biased towards the right. Yeah, but it does actually report stuff that the right wing doesn't want to be reported. Ah, Robbie Gibb, pro-Brexit, went to work for Theresa May. Imagine the left-wing equivalent of that. Imagine somebody who was on the record as being opposed to Brexit, was allowed to continue in that kind of role at the BBC. Andrew Neil, of course, was publishing The Spectator, soon to be a Daily Mail columnist. But he could do impartiality. He could do a lack of bias. It's quite bizarre. I need to come up with a question. 21 minutes after 10, unless you just want to ring in and share your two penneth already about what's going on today, in which case the number you need is 0345 6060 973. Otherwise, I'll try to come up with a question after this.
LBC.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging, or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah, much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 23 minutes after 10, and the fundamental problem, of course, is that facts are biased. Facts are impartial. Donald Trump incited an insurrection. You heard him do it. And if you don't believe the evidence of your own eyes and ears, or you think the presence of that word peacefully in an hour-long speech is somehow mitigation, then ask the people that undertook the insurrection why they did it, and they'll tell you. I presume almost every single one of them, certainly the 210 whose testimony has been tracked down and logged, And that's the problem that some people have with the BBC. But look, this is stupid. Big mistake. Should it have gone all the way upstairs? No. I'll tell you why it did shortly. There's a brilliant piece published by The Observer this morning, and they will know what they are talking about. But the idea that this is somehow a graver offence than lying about an election or inciting an insurrection, it's comical. And, of course, tragical, which might be the second word I've made up this morning. Al's in Glasgow. Al, what would you like to say?
Yeah, hi. I think, did the edit misrepresent or defame Trump? No. He used the word fight 20 times.
Is it 20?
Yeah.
Gosh.
And other terms like marching to the Capitol building, under siege, that sort of thing. So it was an aggressive speech. I think it was clearly inciting violence and insurrection. So I don't think the BBC should have apologised.
Really? Oh, no, you can't. You can't, Doctor.
Oh, sorry, sorry. Yeah, I think they maybe should have apologised, but no resignation.
They tried to. They tried to apologise on Monday, and guess who rejected the apology that had been put together by Deborah Turness, the head of news at the time?
Well,
actually, let's play the game.
Themselves.
Seriously, guess who?
Yeah, I know. Well, in that case,
it was Robbie Gibb.
They should have just said no. You know, you've had your apology. We'll do this internally, but you know, thank you for your attention, but no, we're not going to kowtow.
Because you can't. I mean, no one is defending the silliness of the edit. I'm explaining it. I'm not excusing it. It happened in a room where nobody would have thought it was possible that 12 months later there would actually be a debate about whether or not he incited an insurrection, because that's a matter of record. You've gone back to the speech. You can't sustain the pretense that this is some sort of heinous misrepresentation if you go back to the speech. So you can bet your bottom dollar that Nigel Farage and all the other fellow travellers are not going to know or are not going to mention how many times the word fight was mentioned in the context of this speech, or what on earth was meant by words like steal or siege. So it's an operational problem and a silly decision taken in an editorial suite, which has been turned into something much bigger very deliberately, beginning with the decision to reject the apology that was circulated to board members early last week, and that there was then rejected by politically appointed members of the board. What does the BBC do next, though? Because, I mean, you know, it never seems to acknowledge the scale of the threat against it, the massed ranks of people praying for, devoutly wishing for its destruction and dismantling, so that the field is then left completely clear for people who pay to set the news agenda, large sums of money.
What they could do is rebroadcast the problem and amend the editing, so they could include the fight,
yeah.
You know, so they could give exactly the same context, but actually say, okay, here's an amended version, and people would make the same conclusions, I think.
And it's an hour long, so if you wanted to distill the central points down into a clip, then you would probably be able to make a case for editing it, as they always have done, but not knowing the kind of ludicrous and very dishonest scrutiny that was going to be brought to bear by elements of the UK media one year later. Oh, and guess who brought in the guy that wrote this leaked dossier? No prizes, Robbie Gibb. 27 minutes after 10 is the time. Thank you. Al, Nitsan's in Northampton. Nitsan, what would you like to say?
It's not about the incitement of the insurrection, James. I agree with you with everything you have said so far, apart from one thing.
Go on.
Journalists, we want journalists that give the whole picture. And as a journalist, words are very, very, very powerful. What the BBC did in that edit is made something that was really, really bad and incited insurrection into something just that slightly worse.
Yeah, you're right.
Words are really, really powerful, James. And you.
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing with you. I mean, it was a stupid thing to do. But crucially, and the reason why it was so stupid.
I don't know whether it's a stupid thing to do or whether it's a deceitful thing to do, or what was going through the mind of that editor at the time. It didn't need to be done, like you, me and you can agree on, but words are very powerful. In order to show your opponents up, you have to be whiter than white.
Yep.
You don't fight downwards, you fight up.
I agree with all of this. I don't know what you thought we disagreed about.
But you can't just dismiss...
I'm not. That needed a big apology. Re-edit. Needed a mea culpa, needed a re-edit. What it didn't need was a very, very politically motivated...
The problem with the BBC, James,
yes,
is I'm a fan of the BBC just like you. When they get things wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the head of news and the director general and the chairman spoke about this in a meeting 6 months ago. If they would have, after that meeting, said, we've done something wrong, I'm sorry about that, none of this would have happened. It's the fact that the cogs in the communications at the BBC work far too slow in this fast...
Well, this is why the Observer piece today is so interesting, and there are people in this organisation who have got the BBC, I mean, previously, in their blood. The level of contacts being deployed here would be off the charts. At the beginning of last week, an apology was drafted that was sent to the Culture, Media and Sport Committee by Samir Shah, the chair. He circulated a copy to his board members. A number of them rebelled on the grounds that the apology was not clear enough. And this rebellion was led by the politically appointed members of the board.
Why wasn't it done 6 months ago when they first realised it happened?
Because nobody was... It, 6 months ago...
Getting the BBC to turn around on something. They need to act quicker. And this is from somebody who is a fan
I understand your point. And I think... And this may be your position may be stronger than mine, but I can't get past the idea that nobody thought anybody was ever going to be coming from a point where the narrative of inciting insurrection was being challenged.
It doesn't matter. You have to be whiter than white.
No, I'm not arguing that either, but if you're in the room, if you're in the suite and you're putting this stuff together, you're thinking about the world you inhabit. You're not thinking about what the world might look like in 12 months.
Well, you shouldn't be thinking about the world you inhabit or what...
You shouldn't have done it. No one...
You should...
So, no, hang on, because...
As they are.
I'm trying to pin down...
The fact as they are.
No, I agree with you. I'm trying to pin down what we disagree on.
We both know that.
So what should the consequences have been?
I'm not a fan of asking people to resign and stuff, but if the head of news makes the DG aware of this and nothing happens, it's like they've swept it under the carpet and they hope it'll never come to light.
I don't know that I agree with you on that. I suspect... I'm happy to be wrong. I don't know that we'll ever know for sure, but I expect the conversation went, did he say all the things that we reported him as saying? To which you answer it like Eric Morecambe playing the piano with Andre Previn, and you say, yes, he did. He said all the right words, but not necessarily in the right order. And that is where you are, that's where you're left. 03456060973. What does the BBC do next is going to become the crucial question. And my view has always been they should be fighting these attempts to undermine it, these attempts to influence its editorial policy. The idea of someone knighted for services to the Conservative Party marching back in to the BBC from GB News and lecturing its journalists on impartiality. Imagine the left-wing equivalent of that, or the left-wing reversal. And then get back to me. 10:33 is the time. Lottie Morley has your headlines.
The former chief executive of BBC News has insisted the organisation is not institutionally biased after stepping down. Deborah Turnis joined the BBC's Director General Tim Davie in quitting after criticism about Panorama's editing choices. Journalists are accused of conflating two parts of Donald Trump's speech on the night of the US Capitol riots. New centres are being set up across the country to assist veterans with things like healthcare and housing. £27 million of government funding is available, with extra help for servicemen and women at at risk of homelessness. And the Metropolitan Police has arrested more than 140 people as part of an operation targeting crime in London's West End. 100 additional officers from the force were deployed to tackle offences like shoplifting and phone theft. LBC weather, scattered showers for most of England and Wales, heavier in Scotland, feeling mild with highs of 15 degrees.
LBC.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden.
Can they have their ball back, please?
We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
A Southern Train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to recharge yourself and your phone. To stretch out, sit back, and when you hear "all change, please," you'll know you already have. Go with your flow and save with advance tickets at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
36 minutes after 10, some breaking news for you. Gary Lineker has been appointed the new Director General of the BBC. I'm sure you'll join me in wishing him all the very best as he attempts to get the corporation back on an even keel. I mean, the question of how do you restore trust in the BBC? The question is, how much trust should it have lost? How much trust should it have hemorrhaged over this dossier put together by a man who was put in the job by Robbie Gibb, who received a knighthood for... or is reportedly a friend of Robbie Gibb, who received the knighthood for services to the Tory party. This chap, is it Michael Prescott? Oh, and by the way, Boris Johnson wanted him to advise upon appointing a head of Ofcom when the man in the frame to become the head of Ofcom was the editor of the Daily Mail, Paul Dacre, who famously never uses a computer. So Boris Johnson wanted to give him oversight on all internet regulation in this country, and he famously never uses a computer. So once again, you want to talk about bias, you want to talk about trust. I've got all the receipts. I've got all the receipts. Most, but not all of them. I didn't know the bit about him advising on the Ofcom role, are in my book, How They Broke Britain. Huge swathes of coverage on the BBC, most of it negative. But, they've got a big problem here. They've got an existential problem created largely by coverage. If they lose their seat in the White House press room, which I think is probably 52%, 48, and get replaced by a representative from the Nigel Farage propaganda machine that is the Sir Paul Marshall-funded GB News, scrupulously impartial and unbiased organisation. Should I tell you how impartial and unbiased the Daily Mail is? It's claiming credit for this story today, despite the fact that everybody knows it was a Daily Telegraph scoop. Everybody knows this is a Daily Telegraph story, except Daily Mail readers, who think it was all down to them. What would you do, then? I should probably clarify, Gary Lineker hasn't been appointed Director General of the BBC. But he's another great totem, isn't he, of how absurd the coverage of these issues can be. The way in which a sports presenter can somehow carry the can for an entire corporation over things he didn't even do on the BBC. All while, of course, you can be advising other journalists on impartiality despite having a knighthood for services to the Conservatives. It's a strange old business, and it needs to be resisted. But how you resist it, I do not know. And whether or not the BBC it's just going to sort of weather a storm in a teacup, or whether it's got bigger existential ramifications, or whether or not you want to have a little look at what the incoming or what the next Director General should be doing. I do not know. I do not know. What would you do if you were running the place? Genuine question. What would you do if you were running the BBC? I'll tell you what I'd do, but not yet. Tony's in Greenock. Tony, what would you like to say?
Yeah, hi. One of your calls earlier, you mentioned about the fact that Robbie Gibb made the decision. And then you said, well, what
according to the Observer, he led the objections to the apology that was put together a week ago. And of course, the absence of an apology is what allowed the vacuum to be created into which everybody stepped, including the flipping White House.
Sure. So you then followed that up with what should the BBC be doing? And I think while you've got someone like Robbie Gibb at the helm, they're going to do nothing. Robbie Gibb doesn't really care about the BBC. He's a BBC appointee. He's a political appointee.
He's a Conservative appointee. Boris Johnson's government appointed him in 2021.
And, you know, they're no strangers to clamouring for the BBC to be...
I'll read you what the Observer writes this morning. And the Observer, of course, is owned now by an organisation headed by a former BBC head of news. Generally, board directors do not weigh in on decisions about who is being appointed to edit which programmes or the choice of stories and their running order on the news. Full stop, Gibb has.
Well, there you have it. I mean,
so he's up to his elbows.
You know. Yeah, I think he would be quite happy for that, for the discussion to focus on, oh, do we need a BBC? Do we need a publicly funded broadcasting service? And my answer to that would be yes, because what's the alternative? Who buys the BBC if they pulled the funding? It would be one of your pals, you know, the millionaire, billionaire media moguls.
Can't be. Elon Musk might fancy it.
He could afford it.
Probably no one else on the planet could, actually, or certainly no individual.
But there'd be no accountability then. And there is accountability because it's publicly owned. And you talk about GBBs, you talk about Sky News, all these other news outlets, there is zero accountability for the stories. I mean, they could tell us the moon was made of green cheese and tell lies until the cows come
home. And here's my next guest, Nigel Farage, to tell you that the moon is made of green cheese and that is a perfectly normal concern among people with Judeo-Christian or British values.
Yes.
And that's the point. That is the point. BBC have muffed up here. They have made a mistake.
Undoubtedly.
One insider messaged earlier to say, of course, it's not about a 9-second clip from an old panorama, whatever the press release says. It's about having a chairman who thinks sacking somebody will make the problem go away when the problem resides in the BBC board, which he chairs, which is being hollowed out by Robbie Gibb and his friends. So everybody in the building knows exactly what's going on. The first line, indeed, of this Observer editorial today. If the BBC was able today to report what it thinks, it would say this. There has been a coup. Davey and Turness have been forced out. And then the question becomes, why? And the answer is, well, if you were an editorial advisor to GB News and you moved effortlessly over to the BBC at Boris Johnson's invitation, who here would argue with the idea that the plan was to make the BBC a bit more like GBBs?
100%.
And why else would you do it? Why else would you do it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think if the narrative goes towards, you know, what's the value of the BBC and all, and let's get rid of it, you're going to lose, and it's just chipping away of democratic... discussion, because for all the wrongs and rights of the BBC, they do get a lot of things right.
Yes, of course they hardly ever get credit for, except at awards ceremonies. But that idea of putting out the whole programme with the controversial edit removed and asking an impartial jury of viewers to decide whether or not the central thrust or meaning of the programme has been in any way changed, it's too late for that. But that's the point, really. That's why this line about a 9-second clip from an old panorama is so pertinent. You played out that programme without the spliced edit, it wouldn't have lost any of its impact. That's why it's doubly stupid. It was stupid to do it, and it was stupid to not respond sooner. But now that we're getting a better indication or a better understanding of why there was a slowness to respond, it all begins to make sense. Why do these organisations and, to a certain extent, individuals hate the BBC so much? That's why, if you're in the industry, the question that pops into your mind is, what can the BBC do to restore trust? If you're not in the industry, or if you're in the industry and you're not in thrall to a narrative defined almost entirely now by media owners, true in this country, even more true in the United States. The question really is, how much trust should they have lost in the first place? How much trust should they have lost in the first place? How much of the coverage in the Times, for example, mentioned that the bloke who wrote this dossier used to be the political editor of the Sunday Times? Or that he's friends with Robbie Gibb? And what is the job of journalism? How much trust has the BBC lost? Or how does the BBC restore trust? How does Rupert Murdoch restore trust in his media organisation after it got hit with God knows how big a fine for misreporting Donald Trump's claims or amplifying Donald Trump's claims about the counting machines in the election that Donald Trump lied about losing? Or lied about winning. If he'd said he'd lost it, he would have told the truth. And they all sit there, sharpening their knives, go, oh, the BBC. An unfortunate 9-second edit. That's absolutely terrible. Anyone remember how much Murdoch's operation paid out to the makers of that, of those counting machines? But what I'd like you to do now is queue up to take a lecture on impartiality and journalistic integrity from Checks Notes, Rupert Murdoch and Nigel Farage.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
As the Chancellor prepares to break her promises on tax rises, I'm assembling the biggest names in business to offer some advice to Rachel Reeves. Tomorrow, recruitment giant James Reid will be here to take your calls. On Wednesday, I'll be joined by the man who brought down Barings Bank, Nick Leeson. Labour-supporting dragon Deborah Meaden is here on Thursday. Your chance to question the big beasts of business about what Rachel Reeves needs to be ready for.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Well, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad! Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use,
interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
At Lathwaite's, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide, searching high, and we mean really high, and low, and we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at lathwaites.co.uk. Lathwaite's. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Train to Brighton with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating's going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand. Oh, I'm going up.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train. Only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
10:48 is the time, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. $787 million was the amount of money paid out by Rupert Murdoch's operation to Dominion voting systems after they amplified Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 presidential election. And that settlement was reached partly because they were going to call Rupert Murdoch himself to give evidence. But who here wouldn't take lessons on journalistic integrity from the people people on the hook for almost $800 million for amplifying lies. And speaking of amplifying lies, a story you might have missed while discussing a nine-second edit in an old panorama. The White House announced late last night that pardons are to be issued for the members of his campaign legal team that essentially engaged in attempts to supplant duly elected state electors with their own individuals. So this is, I mean, extraordinary. Rudy Giuliani, remember him? Kenneth Cheeseborough, Sidney Powell, all involved in a scheme to alter the slates of electors chosen by states that voted against the Republican nominee in that year's presidential election. 77 people pardoned overnight for involvement in, whatever you want to call it, profoundly undemocratic and dishonest behaviour, criminal behaviour in many cases. In fact, would it be in all cases? Can you pardon someone who hasn't been found to be guilty of something? It included several Americans who participated directly as members of the slates of false electors, whose purpose was to supplant duly elected state electors bound to cast their state's votes in the Electoral College for Joe Biden. And there it is, pardons for them, pardons to the left of me, pardons to the right of me, pardons down the middle of, pardons for everybody. And of course, the people who are on that side of the political divide, if you can talk about such a thing, are today going after the BBC. But it doesn't change the salience of the question of what the BBC should do. And I think they should start fighting these people. You know, I think they should start recognizing the mortal threat that they are in, because there are people in this country who dream of a newly installed prime minister having a row of media owners sitting behind him rather than a row of cabinet members. There are people in this country who dream of being in that row. And when you see the role that Paul Marshall is playing at GB News and the platform given to Nigel Farage, you realize that that's not a fever dream. People using their money to bankroll organizations that pump out propaganda while hemorrhaging money, so you're not in it for the cash, and promoting politicians or promoting political platforms, make the media owners the most powerful people in the country, except, of course, for the leader. In America, they are simultaneously bending the knees and doffing the cap at Donald Trump. And people want that to happen here. Boris Johnson wanted Charles Moore to be the head of the head of the BBC. He wanted Paul Dacre to be the head of Ofcom. They didn't even pretend that they weren't embarked upon an attempt to completely hobble and dismantle any semblance of objectivity or honesty. So when they make a mistake, the question, the single most important thing anybody honest can do is go back to the facts. What are the facts of this case? And that's why the best thing you could do is play out the panorama with the edit unedited and decide whether or not it had done anything particularly heinous or dishonest. Spoiler alert, it hadn't. Anthony's in Cumbrian. I saw last night, Anthony, I don't know why I'm laying this on you just by dint of the fact that you're calling me from Wales, but have you seen the Toby Jones film, Mr. Burton, yet?
I haven't, no.
Well, I cannot recommend it highly enough. Seriously, it made me proud to be Welsh, and I'm Irish.
I did write to you. I wrote you an email a while ago.
I won't have seen that, yeah. Sorry. I get too many.
No, that's all right.
Anyway, what made you pick up the phone today?
Well, all right. The BBC made a silly mistake, and it was probably naivety. It was maybe a slip. You know, they left some cutting on the cutting room floor, but they should have inserted. But that's as far as it goes, as far as the BBC is concerned. This is all Trump. And it's not even Trump, I think. It's Stephen Miller. I really think that what we've got here is the tentacles of a corrupt and really Orwellian society now, reaching across the world. I mean, and it's not just... It's not in America. It's dreadful. But right across the world, and certainly into our own society here in UK... They're touching the very fabric of our society and corrupting it.
I've got the problem that the White House has with the BBC is not when it gets things wrong, as it has done here. No one can argue otherwise. You can have an argument about how wrong. The problem that the White House has with the BBC is what it gets right.
Exactly. Exactly. Do you know, the more I listen to you this morning, James, I'm thinking, well, I've got these argument points that I want to make, but you've just made them before I want to make them.
So I hadn't spotted what...
accused of plagiarism.
Until you started talking, I hadn't spotted what I just said. Until I started listening to you. It's not... Because, I mean, the idea that this overshadows everything that the corporation does is comical. But that it's not what they get wrong that the White House is exercised by. And this is the man who invented alternative facts and fake news so that he could accuse people of telling the truth of telling lies. So when the BBC are on the hook for something that can be construed as a lie, it's certainly a manipulation. You use it as proof that everything they do is a lie when actually the opposite is true. This is the exception that proves the rule.
Yes. So my point is, it's very, very simple, I think. That it's much, much deeper than this. I mean, you've got in this country, we've got an ex-prime minister who should have been sent to prison, really.
It's a bit of a push.
Promoting lies on the side of a bus as part of a political campaign. That is an offence, imprisonable offence. And we did nothing.
It's not an imprisonable offence. There's no question there of the authorities not having properly pursued it. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The rules governing political advertising are nowhere near as strict as the rules governing the advertising of chicken nuggets or washing powder. But that is something that we would do well to fix. But it's not. There might be other things with the VIP lanes and the PPE and the cronyism and those stories are not going away. But the idea that you're going to take lessons in integrity and transparency from Donald Trump's White House is actually hilarious. But it doesn't, of course, address the vexed question of what the BBC should do now. This is the point. It's taken us an hour to get there, and I'm grateful to Anthony for providing the sort of cherry on the icing on the cake. Understand this and you understand everything, right? The White House's problem with the BBC is not what the BBC got wrong. It's what the BBC gets right. And the mission is to remove everybody from the room where it happens that reports accurately on what is happening. And if you're still struggling to understand that as the lies about the 2020 election continue, then I got a bridge I'd like to sell you. And understanding why the BBC did what they did is only possible, or how they could have dropped such a clangor, is only possible if you live in a world where the lies about the 2020 election are irrefutable and obvious. If you somehow inhabit a world where it's debatable, where it's questionable, where it's in need of balance, here is somebody to tell us a lie to balance out the truth, then you understand how this whole story has taken part, how this whole episode has unfolded. Because you're in that room, in that edit, and the only question you're asking is, well, are we doing anything he didn't say? No, he said all the things that we... But put them in a slightly different order that could be construed, if you only watch the 9-second clip and ignore the rest of the 59-minute speech, could be construed as not inciting an insurrection. Yeah, but no one's going to do that. Step forward to Daily Telegraph. In fact, step forward, Robbie Gibb. Hussein is in Birmingham. Hussein, what would you like to say?
So, James, lovely to hear you, mate. You're one of the most independent and people that we come to for information. But my perspective I want to share with you, and it's been going on for a few years, is where is the regulator regarding broadcasters and publishers? I mean, you've mentioned a lot of the times that, you know, the stories aren't true, but if they're false, then over the years, you know, as members of the public, you know, watching what's going on, we can't see the difference now between our politicians and journalists. That line seems to have gone. And, you know, people like Reform, they've had years to broadcast and publish and build up, you know, the voters, the electorate. And normally that wouldn't have happened. I mean, years ago, you never even heard of, you know, there used to be a line that wasn't crossed. But I don't seem to see that anymore. And I don't see the regulator. And, you know, you're always saying Britain's broken, it's not being governed properly. But I don't think it's been regulated properly either.
The objective nature of truth and reality is not regulated. The BBC... this is something that's a bit of a bugbear of mine, and other people may disagree, but it goes back to climate change, oddly enough, when you'd invite somebody on to argue that it wasn't real. when it is. I mean, it's like inviting someone on to argue that the moon is made of cheese, is the analogy I've always used. And that bled into what then became known as the Minford paradigm, which Emily Maitlis explains a lot better than I do. When she was presenting Newsnight, the world's economists would be queuing up to explain why Brexit was a stupid idea, but they felt the need to have somebody on who'd argue that it was a brilliant idea, and they could only generally find one person called Patrick Minford. So it became known as the Minford paradigm, and it gets presented to viewers as equal and opposite forces, 50-50. And this is close to what's happening here, in that you're almost now at the door where we're now going to invite, in fact, they probably have, haven't they? They have people like Steve Bannon on, Rudy Giuliani. We're now going to invite someone on to claim that Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 election are not lies. And the BBC keeps doing it, and I don't know what it should do instead, but it ain't this. It ain't this. They're saying thank you. The time is approaching 11 o'clock. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I began the hour by saying this, and I'll say it again. If you want to really sustain your fury at the BBC this morning, or sustain your unhappiness or your anger, if indeed such a thing exists, then do not, whatever you do, go back to the actual speech that they reported and spliced and edited. But if you were to take anything else away from this morning's hour, first hour, there's lots more to come, do not panic, including Simon Marks at 11:45, then you are looking at the very simple question of what would have happened if they put this documentary out without the edit in it? What would have changed? To which I suspect the answer, genuinely, is absolutely nothing.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the outgoing CEO of BBC News says there's no institutional bias at the corporation. Deborah Turnus has stepped down alongside the Director General, Tim Davey. She spoke to reporters this morning.
Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
Journalists are being criticised for the way they edited a speech from Donald Trump on the night of the Capitol riots in 2021. Former director of BBC Television, Danny Cohen, told LBC it's important the organisation takes the right next step.
It's actually an opportunity for the BBC now to change, to recognise what's gone wrong, and see if they could make themselves more fit for purpose for the future. My concern actually is that there'll almost be too much focus on the Dr. Trump edit and the cover-up of that, when what Mr. Prescott report reveals is a much wider problem of systemic bias.
We're just hearing a 34-year-old woman has now died in hospital after being stabbed in Birmingham. She was attacked in the city on Friday night, and a 21-year-old man has been arrested. Nearly £30 million of government funding is going live to help veterans across the country. Centres are being rolled out to make it easier for servicemen and women to access support services. The president of the COP30 climate talks says rich nations should follow China's lead. Despite being the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter, it's also the largest producer of green technologies. A court in France will decide whether former President Nicolas Sarkozy can be released from prison later. He's just spent 20 days in jail after being sentenced to 5 years for criminal conspiracy, which he denies. And teachers across England will now be assessed using a new colour-coded system. Ofsted is replacing single-word grading with more detailed comments. They'll look at areas including quality of education, behaviour and leadership. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 99 points at 97.82. The pound buys $1.31 and a euro 13. LBC weather, scattered showers for most of England and Wales. Those are heavier in Scotland, feeling mild with highs of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
3 minutes after 11 is the time. Last word on this. BBC journalists are not allowed opinions. Well, that's not true. You can publish the Spectator magazine, and indeed spend your time at the BBC as a sort of apprenticeship for becoming a Daily Mail column. But if you have opinions that the Daily Mail doesn't like, then you are not, going to be able to hold on to your job if they are expressed. You'd even get into trouble when you don't express them because people think you might look a little bit, look a little bit liberal. I remember Emily Maitlis getting into trouble for liking one of my tweets, which was expressing an opinion at the time, but it was national news, according to the Daily Mail. But Robbie Gibb, the man at the heart of this story regarding the Donald Trump speech, knows that. He knows that BBC journalists aren't allowed to offer up opinions ever. And yet he told them, if your tweets are consistently liked or retweeted by one side of the political divide, ask yourself why that is and change. So if, as a BBC journalist, you are only in the business of tweeting facts, and facts seem to be more popular with one side of the political divide than the other, then Robbie Gibb, BBC executive, non-executive board member, thinks that you should change. And so if your facts, you're tweeting facts and it's really popular, what on earth should you be doing instead? Tweeting falsehoods for balance? Or tweeting fewer facts? And he actually wrote that down. That's how stupid the man is. He actually wrote that down. Incredible. If your tweets are consistently liked or retweeted by one side of the political divide, ask yourself why that is and change. And BBC journalists will get into huge amounts of trouble if they dare to tweet an opinion. So I couldn't stay on as a very, very, very occasional presenter of Newsnight, because my opinions expressed on this programme and elsewhere upset people like Robbie Gibb and the editor of the Daily Mail. Doesn't matter. I could have published The Spectator. That would have been fine. But my little Twitter account, that was unbearable. That was unsustainable. And I did tweet opinions. But if a BBC journalist is tweeting facts, evidence-based journalism, and it's more popular with one side of the political divide than the other, then what you really should be asking yourself is why one side of the political divide loves lies so much and hates the truth. Which is exactly where we are this morning. And how many people are allowed to say so in the UK media? It's also worth asking yourself that question. 5 minutes after 11 is the time. Right. I saw a piece in the Financial Times the other day, and there's a brilliant piece on the subject we were talking about in the last hour in today's Financial Times newsletter by the inimitable Stephen Bush. But I saw a piece last week that said, I don't think, I'm going to do it. I'm going out on a limb. I'm biting the bullet. Rachel Reeves is not going to put up income tax. And I'd read it, I think, just a few hours before it became relatively clear via her comments to the Office for Budgetary Responsibility that she was indeed going to put up income tax. Indeed, the way it was reported is that she told the budget watchdog that she planned to increase income tax. And I felt for that commentator because it was a well-argued and a well-thought-out piece, but it was rendered wrong almost immediately after they pressed send on the article. I think I'm safe with what I'm about to do because I'm looking at the Chancellor's exchange with the OBR in which she talked about a rise in personal taxation being one of the major measures that she is preparing to announce later this month. November the 26th. Would you indulge a brief tangent, a tangential departure? I'm looking forward to the budget for the first time in my life. I don't mean because of what it will contain for me, because it will almost certainly contain bad news for me, while most budgets under Tory prime ministers or Tory chancellors contain good news for me as a comfortably off high earner. It's almost always, not always, I don't think, but almost always extremely good news for the likes of me. And who here doesn't think that budgets should be fine-tuned to make people like me a little bit better off than we were already, as opposed to addressing any of the other issues facing the country? Exactly. I'm looking forward to this one for political reasons. Genuinely fascinated by how it is going to land. On the one hand, you've got relatively sensible people arguing that her position becomes immediately untenable if she abandons the manifesto pledge not to raise income tax. She will have to resign. Again, I don't think she will. I don't think she will have to resign, and I don't think she will resign when she announces that she is putting up income tax. But I'm fascinated by the cognitive dissonance of knowing as a nation that we need to raise more money, whether it's 70 billion or 90 billion or 40 billion. I think 70 is the widely accepted figure. Everybody knows that we need to do this. Can have arguments about when people realized it and whether they admitted it at the same time that they realized it. But nobody really looks at the state of the country and thinks we should be spending less on infrastructure. We should be spending less on people who are struggling. We should be spending less on the things we all rely on, whether it's roads or the NHS. Nobody looks at the state of the nation and thinks we should be spending less. The deeply dishonest sort of Tufton Street-inspired ideology that thinks that you can do all of the things that need to be done by closing more libraries in Wolverhampton or taking away the pittance that really vulnerable people currently receive from the state, reducing those sort of things, that seems, despite the best efforts of some Tories, that seems to have lost its oomph. Quite good in many ways that Reform UK won councils on a promise to cut spending and then arrived in those councils and realised that they wouldn't be able to keep any promises to cut spending because 14 years of austerity had already started shaving off bits of bone, never mind cutting to it. So we know, right, that we need to raise more money. And I like we in this context because that's what patriotism sounds like. We need to raise more money. I don't think I would benefit from increased public spending, except possibly in the area of the NHS. But my goodness me, I want to live in a country where we are plugging some of the holes in the public infrastructure and making things better for as many people as possible. So we know that, right? And yet we also live in a country where it is still treated like political kryptonite, where raising income tax is still treated like political kryptonite. And I'm increasingly, as I get older, drawn to the subjects that I can't solve. We might do another one next. I used to love the subjects that we'd end an hour together and think that we had actually come up with an answer. I think we kind of did in the last hour. The White House doesn't have a problem with the stuff that the BBC gets wrong. The White House has a huge problem with the stuff that the BBC gets right. You might want to stick that on a T-shirt. But I love the subjects now that we can talk about without much expectation of certainty at the end of it, just perhaps increasing illumination, coming to a better understanding of things. And that's why, for the first time, I don't know whether I should tell you this, the first time in all the years that I've been doing this job, I'm looking forward to the budget. Not the, you know, the meat and two veg of its content. I'm looking forward to what happens afterwards. I'm looking forward to what the political ramifications are of, I hope, a 2p in the pound increase in income tax, and maybe a reduction in employee national insurance contributions, which was one of this government's earlier perceived missteps. I don't know how it's going to land. So what I'm doing, the reason I mentioned the fellow who wrote an article about how he didn't think that Rachel Reeves was going to put up income tax, only for her to tell the OBR hours later that she was going to put up income tax, is that I'm going to predicate this entire hour, or at least 45 minutes, because Simon Marks is with us at 11:45. Don't miss that. He'll have a lot to say about recent events. But I'm starting from the point that she's putting up income tax. Rachel Reeves is going to put up your income tax. She might work out a way to exclude those on the lowest incomes, and of course, as a champagne socialist, I hope that she does. But she is going to put up your income tax. Rachel Reeves is going to put up your income tax. And that is absolutely fascinating, isn't it? On a political level, or a personal level. Before we even get into the fiscal, because you're not really going to be able to judge whether it was a good idea or not, or whether it was the right thing to do or not, until we see the impact of it. It is the right thing to do. It is not a panacea or a guarantee of any of the things that she will promise will be achieved as a consequence of doing it. Only time will tell whether or not those promises are kept. But Rachel Reeves is going to put up your income tax. You can play this clip back come November the 27th and laugh at my idiocy and wrongheadedness. There's a first time for everything. But Rachel Reeves is going to put up income tax, going to put up your income tax. And I am minded, very simply, to ask you how you feel about that. How do you feel about that? How do you greet the news? It's not news. I should also stress that I was joking when I said that Gary Lineker was going to be the next Director General of the BBC. It would appear from my inbox that a few people still believe me. I thought it was an obvious joke. I should probably also say that when I came in at the end of next programme earlier and explained that I was tidying up my CV prior to applying for the job of Director General at the BBC, that was a joke as well. Or was it? That was a joke as well, okay? Or was it? But the Gary Lineker thing, definitely a joke. Gary Lineker has not been announced as Director General of the BBC, and although I'll ask him about it when he joins me on stage in February, I am fairly certain that he wouldn't be interested in the job either. 11:13 is the time. I am interested in how you are going to greet an increase to your income tax. So what I think she'll probably use the NI cut to help some of the people on lower incomes. But for the rest of us, including, I suspect, pensioners and landlords, that there are going to be higher taxes. But it's income tax in particular that I'm interested. Okay. How will you respond when, not if, Rachel Reeves puts your income tax up? Okay. And why? I want you to tell me what your response is and or will be and why. 03456060973. I don't know why it's taken me the best part of 20 years to get interested in this stuff. I think it's because it's always felt really obvious and predictable. And now it isn't. Now we live in a country where everybody thinks that the Treasury needs more money and nobody thinks that they should be the ones providing it. I think also Tory budgets, I just found them so difficult to process. Sitting here being told that I was going to be better off than I was already while looking at food banks popping up all over the country or Sure Start centres closing or the NHS losing staff or teachers losing their classroom assistants and looking at the detail of a George Osborne budget and thinking, I think I'm going to be better off next year than I was last year. How can that be? And it's hard to do it on the radio because some people will accuse you of political bias and some people will accuse you of boasting about how well off you are. And you can't really win. So I don't know whether that is the reason why I'm so engaged with it this time around, because I think that we might be looking at a budget that genuinely attempts to recognise the reality of distribution or income distribution in this country. But what would success look like? That's going to be my second question. So how are you going to greet the increase in income tax? Hand on heart. Tell me why you're furious. Or tell me why you're happy. 03456060973. Any action. And remember, it's hard to have this conversation independently of the manifesto promise not to do it. I do think, well, personally, you might disagree. I do think that casts a very important shadow over any dialogue that we have together now. They promised they wouldn't do it, and they're going to do it. How do you feel about it? How will you greet the news when it comes, as it almost certainly will? And then the second bit, this is not a question I ask you often enough, actually. Rachel Reeves increases income tax. She raises tens of billions of pounds for the public purse. What does success look like? What will you be looking for as proof that it was the right thing to do? That is a massive, massive goldmouth. Those posts could barely be further apart. What would success look like? I don't think it's going to, quotes, stop the boats, end quotes. That doesn't seem to me to be a fiscal matter. That's a matter of diplomacy, international relations and human rights. But in almost every other area of governance, a big increase or a meaningful increase in income tax will be judged a success or a failure by you and you alone, according to what happening or not happening. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 03456060973 is the number that you need. So, a rare example of me putting my head on the block without being 100% certain that I'm right. Rachel Reeves is going to put up your income tax. How do you greet that news, given that she promised not to when you quite possibly voted for her party to become the party of government? Does that matter to you, that little wiggle, that wrinkle there, that hypocrisy, that dishonesty, that abandonment of an original position? And the second question is, when she does it, what will you be looking for as proof that it was the right thing to do. And if it doesn't turn up, you'll be led towards the conclusion that it was the wrong thing to do. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. It is 11:18.
This is LBC.
This November at Wren, it's Black Friday. Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. Because all this month you can get up to 60% off our high-quality, fully built kitchen units and up to 50% off selected quartz worktops. Plus, up to 7 years interest-free credit. Made for making every November day a deal day. Wren. Made for living. Visit your nearest Wren showroom. Offers apply when you buy five or more kitchen units. Quartz offer ends 19th November. Finance subject to status and minimum spend.
Now, let me ask y'all a question. Are you ready to ditch the crowds and the cookie-cutter holidays? I'm talking quiet mornings spent by crystal-clear lakes, cruising across the vast landscapes of Canada and the U.S. at a leisurely pace, stopping at charming towns and saying howdy. Go deeper with littleamerica.co.uk.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
It's 20 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I think, I don't know, but it's pretty clear that the income tax is going up, probably by 2p, while you also get a 2p cut in national insurance in an attempt to shift the burden of tax rises away from workers and onto other groups, pensioners and landlords, being at the front of that particular queue. And it might raise as much as £6 billion a year, which I think we'd all agree the Treasury desperately needs. So how will you greet this news if, stroke, when it happens? Amy is in Salisbury to kick things off. Amy, what would you like to say?
Oh, gosh, I find it so depressing. I'm going to be really honest. I feel like I'm being really negative, but I don't know how small businesses like me are going to survive. So we're pushed to try and employ more people. We've already had the national minimum wage increase, which means that my staff get paid more than I do. Then a hit on that is the income tax. I want to keep going because, you know, we need to employ people, but I don't know how companies like myself are going to sustain if they keep taking from us.
Well, I mean, the most obvious thing I can say by way of reassurance is that if you're really taking home less than the national minimum wage, then there's no earthly way you're going to be affected by an income tax rise.
Well, potentially.
There's no possibly about it. You'll be millions of miles away from being in the catchment area for an income tax rise if your net income is lower than your gross income is lower than the national minimum wage, which is £12.21 an hour, I think.
But my I'm married, so my husband will be affected by that. So okay. As a family unit, that's gonna affect.
Okay,
us.
But I mean, you did use your small business as the reason why you'd be objecting to it.
Well, to be honest, I've got heaps of reasons to object to it.
Okay.
I don't.
Well, that one, respectfully, that one doesn't work, does it? Because if you're taking home less than £12.21 an hour, you're not going to be hit with an income tax rise in a million years.
No, I'm not taking home less than that. But what I'm saying is I'm taking home less than my employees. I pay them well. They've had a national minimum raise. And so that's not the only unit that's affecting us each time that woman speaks. We're hit from every angle, whether it's a personal income, whether it's a business, whether it's talking about tax on electric car. I just feel like as a community, we're hit really badly.
Okay. I lean to liberalism in my politics, so I wouldn't say then that the rules of the market mean that if you can't wash your face, then you're in the wrong business. That would be a very right-wing response in some circumstances to this kind of scenario. But what do you say to the observation that the country is in obvious and desperate need of more public spending, not less?
I think they need to reallocate their spending, in all honesty. I think some of the spending, I don't want to go into really political things.
But, well, I might ask you to, because, I mean, we need to work out where we're going to take the money away from after 14 years of it being taken away from the NHS, schools, police, roads, where would you go next?
I actually don't want to answer that question. All I know is that there's heaps of homeless veterans that are out there at the moment with no homes.
Well, that involves more public spending, not less. So that would be an argument in favour of tax rises.
But we won't have any businesses left. People will leave the country. We won't have any business to be able to put into it. I guess what you're saying, I just feel that...
I'm not really saying anything. I'm just asking you about the things you're saying. Because at the moment, the only thing you've come up with would involve an increase in public spending, which would demand tax rises.
Or a reallocation of some particular funding. I'm absolutely not going to get into this argument.
I don't know where you're going. I mean, it's odd that you say that. Do you mean immigration, perhaps, or asylum seekers?
I mean that there are small to medium-sized businesses that have a really good turnover, that want to be loyal, want to have staff, and they're the ones that I feel are hit the most when you get the...
I heard that the first time. I heard that. But you know how this programme works. I have to reserve the right to ask you a few questions about what you say. Otherwise, we turn into what people want the BBC to become, which is where you just report whatever it is that's being said without ever asking why. Or could you just explain that a little, please? Or not? I'm not you. I'm not having a go at you. I'm having a go at the people attacking the BBC. But and I don't know. My antennas twitch a bit when somebody says I'm not going to go where you know where I'm going to go. I don't know. I have no idea where you're going to go. But you know, the kind of people who think suddenly that homeless veterans are a cause of major concern seem to be the same sort of people who think that asylum seekers are a major drain upon our economy, which, spoiler alert, they're really not in the context of what this country currently needs. But if that's where you were going to go, fair enough. Don't feel shy next time of saying so. And if that's not where you were going to go, I apologise for misrepresenting you. But that's the thing about vacuums, is that anything can move into them. Brian is in Oldham. Brian, what do you reckon?
Hi, James.
Hello,
I'm probably very different from you. I'm probably
what?
A small...
Are you not handsome? Are you not handsome and clever, Brian? This is outrageous.
That's for other people to decide,
very
isn't
true,
it?
Very true, very true.
But as a small C conservative, most of my life, taxes, yes. I've always wanted lower taxes and I've always wanted better government. What I think we've got to do as grown-ups at this moment in time is accept the fact that we're in the mire, probably partly or mostly because of the money that was threw all over the place in COVID. And we all knew at the time, at some point, we would have to pay that back. So a success for me now would be, for as much as I loathe to say it, an addition to income tax to say this is the pain that we've got to pay back, that we all knew we would have to pay back at some point. If we can counter that with maybe looking at public spending and trying to make savings, not increase it, but try to make savings or redirect it in the right way, because there does seem to be some waste. But I think we have to be grown up now.
There's not much waste left. I mean, I'm sure we can find something, but in the great scheme of things, I do think that's an unhelpful. After 14 years of austerity, if there's any waste left, then we should get a refund off David Cameron and George Osborne. Shouldn't we?
Yeah, so I'll grant you that, but there's got to be different ways of working things, possibly.
I agree with you. And you know what doesn't get talked about enough is furlough. I don't know whether it's because of all the parties that Boris Johnson turned out to be having and Dominic Cummings driving to Barnard Castle and all the terrible cronyism surrounding the VIP lanes. But when furlough was brought in, we knew. I thought, Brian, it was going to turn the whole country socialist, even you. I thought we were going to recognise that actually, you know, that you do need the state to have a huge role in economics, because when things like this happen, everybody's going to get some help, everybody that needs it. And I know some people who needed it didn't get help, but my point stands. And therefore, we will all have to pay it back. Even people who didn't go on furlough are going to have to put their shoulder to the wheel and refill the fiscal holes created by paying people to work when they weren't working. And that doesn't get talked about enough. Brexit is still controversial. It shouldn't be. The costs of Brexit are going up. There's a brilliant piece published today, which I'll go into later. But all of the things that demand more public spending are obvious, right? Obvious.
Yeah, and we've got to be adult about it and accept the fact that if any of the parties at the last election had been honest with us and said, look, we're in dire straits, we are going to need to repay everything from COVID, I'm sure the vast majority of normal thinking people would have said, yes, we'll accept that.
I don't know, and we never will we? That's the thing about counterfactuals. Their calculation was clearly that they can't say that, and whether they're being entirely honest or not when they say, oh, gosh, whoops-a-daisy, we didn't think things were quite as bad as they've turned out to be, therefore we're going to have to abandon that promise, is one for the ages. But I agree with you. The first caller didn't. You know, the idea that it is absolutely obvious that we need to raise taxes in order to raise the national income is not as self-evident as some people like Brian and like me, from very different political backgrounds, have concluded. What are you going to do when she puts the income tax up? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. It's coming up to 11:30. Orin is in Burton-on-Trent. Orin, what made you pick up the phone?
Morning, James. I think we're going to be very much in agreement here. I think the problem that the Labour Party and Rachel Reeves specifically have got at the moment is the way that its income tax going up looks so bad optically.
Yeah.
Saying it in the manifesto, we're not going to do it without understanding the full state that the Tories left the country in economically, was a bit naive, if anything.
That's quite generous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that thing where almost people are hearing income taxes being going up. And I don't think I think that's the thing they're hearing, rather than your choice is income tax goes up, or we see more austerity as we've seen over the last 15 years. And I can talk from experience. I mean, I grew up on a council estate not too far away from yourself in Stourbridge.
Oh, lovely.
And now I'm actually doing all right for myself now, right? But I think I look at it and go, am I okay paying an extra £40-£50 a month in income tax if it goes up 1%?
Yeah,
absolutely. If it means that doesn't repeat itself.
And what will you be looking for? So the political shenanigans about the manifesto pledge abandonment aside, what will you be looking for in Burton-on-Trent as in your life as evidence that it's worked or that it has touched the sides of what you wanted to change?
Improvement in public services, which I think is a really easy thing to say, but I think it's that thing that needs to actually hit people's lives. I think people actually need to see that difference. I think your first caller probably touched on it a little bit around asylum seekers, and I think people are making a bit of a misjudgment that the increase in income tax and the increase in asylum seekers are correlated, rather than actually them both being caused by Brexit and the other things that have happened, and people are almost putting two and two together and making 12.
I guess if you were responsible for Brexit, you'd probably be quite keen for the people that you conned to think that asylum seekers are the reason why the country is in
absolutely. I had a conversation with a friend of mine on Saturday night where he was saying, oh, they're all as bad as each other, but Labour are the worst, they're going to put taxes up, and it came onto asylum seekers, and he couldn't get his head around the fact illegal versus asylum seeker.
No, of course.
And it's that thing where now, I think income tax is going up, it just adds more fuel to that fire, which concerns me. And I think you said last week, didn't you, that the second most important thing that people are seeing at the moment is... I can't remember what it was. I think you said it was...
If you ask them about the country, I mean, it's cost of living for everybody comes top on both, but you ask people what's the biggest problem in the country, then immigration comes second. You ask them what the biggest problem in their life is, or their community, or their town, and it comes seventh. So, well done, everybody. That's a very successful propaganda campaign.
Absolutely.
I like that. And if the waiting lists come down, I don't know, would we get told? would you find the information that you needed in the media ecosystem that we've been talking about for the first hour this morning? Thank you for that, Orin. Stourbridge is popping up quite a lot on the programme at the moment, and I like it. Home of, I will tell you again, one of the shortest train lines in the world, if not the shortest. I think there's some dispute about that. It's unlikely, however, to feature in Lottie Morley's headlines.
The outgoing chief executive of BBC News has insisted the organisation is not institutionally biased. Deborah Turness joined the BBC's Director General Tim Davey in quitting after criticism about Panorama's editing choices. Journalists are accused of editing Donald Trump's speech on the night of the Capitol riots in a way that misled viewers. A 34-year-old woman has died after being stabbed in the neck in Birmingham on Friday night. A man had been charged with attempted murder after the attack. West Midlands Police says it's made an application to update it. And nearly £30 million of government funding is going live to help veterans across the country. Centres are being rolled out to make it easier for servicemen and women to access support services. LBC weather, scattered showers for most of England and Wales, those heavier in Scotland, feeling mild with highs of 15 degrees.
This is LBC. Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
It's that time of year again, which can only mean one thing. Save a third off roasting joints at Waitrose. Choose from tender beef silverside, succulent whole brined and seasoned chicken, or juicy beach smoked gammon. So, fire up your ovens and give winter a warm welcome with a third off roasting joints. Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and Concessions. Offer ends 11th of November.
Train to Cambridge and then all aboard the paddleboards. A little bit different, should be fun. Or wobbly, or wet.
The wetsuit's a good look on you, Steve.
Oh, actually, this is very relaxed.
George is up the River Cam without a paddle.
Train home, that was such a laugh. I think I might even have a new hobby. Download the Thames Link Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel on off-peak journeys. Thames Link Railway, where every stop is a story.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
It is 11:35 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where, I mean, listen, it's funny, isn't it, that when we were talking with Oren a moment ago in Burton, he reminded me of that research, that polling, that just, some things just slap, don't they? They really do. When you look at how the country feels about an issue, and then what happens when you ask them about the relevance of that issue to their own life, and the figures change enormously. So you have immigration coming second after the cost of living, when people are asked about what they think is most important nationally, and then it plummets to seventh. When people are asked about the things that actually affect them. Of course, immigration should, in many ways, be first. Because the way it affects you, if you've been to hospital recently, or if you have a relative in a care home, or if you're relying upon a veterinary practitioner to look after your pets, or all of the areas of life in which, or if indeed you use shops, depending on where you live, the idea that many of those institutions and businesses could be sustained without immigration is absolutely laughable. But it goes from second to seventh when you ask people to map the difference between what they think matters and what actually matters. But cost of living comes top both times, which makes an increase in income tax very, very politically perilous. But it's got to be done. How will you greet it when it is done? The other story, and I mentioned this a moment ago, is that let me get the name of this organization correct, because I am nothing if not scrupulous. The National Bureau of Economic Research, which is an absolute wonk fest. These are the people who really crunch the numbers, know their stuff, leave any political biases at the door, and quite possibly inform either the Office of Budgetary Responsibility or even the Chancellor themselves. But it is, a very august organisation. And they've put together a panel on the economic impact of Brexit and Brexit alone, and an august selection of contributors to this working paper: Nicholas Bloom, Philip Bunn, Paul Mizzen, Pavel Smiatanka, and Gregory Thwaites. And it makes for pretty grim reading, even for those of us who have been under no illusions whatsoever about what Brexit would cost and what Brexit would do to this country. And you can tell that I've lost it because I'm waffling a bit now while desperately trying to find it at the same time. But the short version is that the figures are much higher than they are than was previously expected, or let us say even higher than was previously expected. Don't take my word for it. Here is a quick paragraph from the abstract. This paper examines the impact of the UK's decision to leave the European Union in 2016. Using almost a decade of data since the referendum, we combine simulations based on macro data with estimates derived from micro data collected through our decision-maker panel survey. These estimates suggest that by 2025, Brexit had reduced UK GDP by 6 to 8%, with the impact accumulating gradually over time. So it gets worse, not better, as the years passed. We estimate that investment was reduced by between 12 and 18%, employment by 3 to 4%, and productivity by 3 to 4%. These large negative impacts reflect a combination of elevated uncertainty, reduced demand, diverted management time, and increased misallocation of resources from a protracted Brexit process. Compare it with contemporary forecasts, and they were about accurate over a five-year horizon, but they underestimated the impact over a decade. And here we are, waiting for all the newspapers that told you, and all the radio presenters who told you to vote for Brexit, to come out in united fury at Rachel Rees for putting up income tax as a direct consequence of both the furlough that Boris Johnson introduced and the Brexit that Boris Johnson championed. It's mad, right? Catherine is in Warrington. Catherine, what made you pick up the phone?
Morning, James. It's just infuriating that they're putting the tax up again. You know, hard workers are penalised day in, day out. For me, myself, you know, I'm earning a good salary, but daily is a struggle to even go and buy my shopping, pay all my bills, everything. And it seems to me the harder you work, the harder it gets.
Really?
Yeah, 100%.
Just unpack that for me a bit, if you would.
Yeah, so, you know, you're working hard. I've worked since the day I left school. I was actually 15 when I left. I'm in my 40s now. I've worked every day, and pretty much you're taxed like, to everything. You know, you're taxed for your salary, you're taxed for your house, you're taxed on your food.
We always were. It just feels... Yeah. I mean, the obvious answer is that wages haven't gone up while everything else has, and the people who at the very top of the pyramid have got richer and richer and richer and richer, while wages haven't kept up with all of the other increases in cost, partly because I think for a long time we were a little bit hypnotised by how much our property was going up in value. So we sort of didn't mind that we weren't getting pay rises because our house went up by so much last year.
I mean, for me, you know, I understand the money's got to come from somewhere.
Well,
but
where,
I think they're looking in the wrong... For me,
yeah.
You need to get people back into work. You know, everyone's going on about asylum seekers, things like that. It's not that. You look... Every single place that you go into a local town, I'm from Burnley,
yeah. You
know, the unemployment is extremely high. You look, who's funding that? Well, we are.
Yes.
Why are we funding it? Because people, you know, genuinely are sick, and I 100% agree that they need to be supported. But then you've got, you know, the 20-year-olds that are coming out of education, and then, you know, they've got problems, mental health issues and things like that, and they're getting paid to go on courses to get them back into work and things. No, just get them off the backside and get them a job.
Well, nobody wants to hire them. That's the maddest thing about this, is that I'm not arguing with a lot of what you've said, although I think only a third of the nearly a million people in the category you describe are on any sort of sickness sign-off. We might talk about this in the next hour because the government has... Or it's a big independent review into it. And that's a constant mystery to me. A lot of them aren't claiming. A lot of them are just living at home and carrying on like they were when they were at school, but without any particular income. They get a bit of pocket money off mum and dad. They get their laundry done and their meals cooked. They help themselves to whatever's in the fridge, and they don't feel any particular urgency to get out into the world and...
Well, I've got that. I've got two children.
Yes.
I've got one who's in the military.
Right.
She joined when she was 16, so she's 21 this year. And then I've got an 18, nearly 19-year-old. And irony of tell it, and God knows what you think about this, but he's currently TikToking to make money because... He was working sort of at Tesco's, sorry, another supermarket.
No, you can say what you want. It's not, we don't need to be.
And he was on the minimum wage and he was paying. And then, you know, he saw all his friends earning money online. So that's what he's doing now. And he is slowly starting to fund himself, thankfully.
But that's kind of, I mean, that's an extraordinary call, isn't it, when you think about it? Because for an awful lot of people, he's in the category that you've just described.
Yeah,
he's
no,
one of the people that isn't working and has rejected the world of graft that you want all the other young people to go into.
Yeah, no, but at the same time, you've got all these people that are being brought up generationally by parents who don't work. So then they see and they follow suit. You know, they,
but again,
they
I mean, again, these arguments have been around for as long as time, haven't they? They even predate Margaret Thatcher, and you know, there are probably elements of truth in it then and elements of truth in it now. Statistically, it's not worse now than it was 30 years ago, and the likelihood of growing up in a workless household, I don't think, has gone up. It may even have gone down a little bit. But that
but
sense,
it is making
you can't
it more comfortable.
Do you
people.
Think it is? Because they're worse off than they've ever been. People on unemployment benefits.
Well, they need to look at themselves then and work out why and what they need to change, you know.
What you've got here is a very familiar argument about the people whose income, regardless of whether they're working for it or not, and I know that's quite a big thing to ask you to ignore,
mm-hmm.
but if you're struggling, it's highly unlikely that they're living at large.
Some are. Some are definitely.
Well, we always hear these anecdotes, and I'm sure some are, but generally speaking, if you're struggling to make ends meet, you'd probably be struggling more if you were on an unemployment benefit. But that's where we need
it.
That's where we need to go and get the money.
Yeah,
and of
course,
I think huge numbers of people on Universal Credit now are in work. So again, like you, they don't feel they're being paid enough.
No, and you know, those that are working, that are claiming it, I think, you know, fair play, they are working. They're not looking at the rules and saying, oh, if I continue to do an extra hour here, I'll lose my benefits. The majority will keep working.
I know, but I just don't know. How big do we think the constituency is? Is it big enough to fix the NHS? Is it big enough to fill in all the potholes? Is it big enough to get classroom assistance back in schools? Is it big enough to or are we going to have to put our hands in our pocket as well as a consequence of Brexit that has cost billions and billions and is going up, not down? Furlough, which saw huge numbers of people paid to work when they weren't working. No one calls that an unemployment benefit, but it was.
I was in receipt of that, and even at the time, I said, you know, where is this coming from? Why am I getting paid for not working?
You're about to pay it back by seeing your income tax go up a bit.
Yeah, of course, but you can't keep.
But look at those unemployed people over there.
The
well, I, you literally got paid for not working for how long?
For myself, I think it was sort of 6 weeks. I was furloughed for 6 weeks. It wasn't particularly very long because they found out pretty quickly that I could do my work from home.
No, fair enough. I was hoping you were going to say 4 years and then I'd have won the argument left, right and centre.
But
for a huge number of people, furlough was pretty much for the duration of all the lockdowns. And the idea that that doesn't have to get paid back. And who's going to pay it back?
Well, we always knew it would be us. And yeah, that's acceptable. But what's not acceptable is putting it up and funding everything else that isn't the important. The NHS is important.
No, I hear you. And do you know what I find very helpful? Is that on when you pay your tax on the HMRC website, you can see a pie chart of where it all goes. The temptation to say we need to get it from there and not from me is huge. We all suffer from, almost all of us suffer from that a bit or feel that a bit. But that pie chart for me is probably the most helpful contribution to conversations about tax and the economy that I've ever seen, and you hardly ever see it. You've got to seek it out. But the slice of the pie that goes to the things that we have been very carefully encouraged, very deliberately encouraged over the last several decades to think are the biggest drains on our economy are not the biggest drains upon our economy. I don't know. So when she announces the income tax rise, which I think is going to hit if you're on over 50, I may have got the sums wrong, but the Times Today reports that if you're a basic rate taxpayer below 50,000, then the NI cut will ensure that only the wealthier pay more. Only the basic rate taxpayers earning below about £50,000 are likely to be exempt from the NI cut to ensure that only the wealthier pay more. One of the reasons I don't enjoy these conversations historically is that I do find it still quite hard to understand. Where's Martin Lewis when you need him? But if the massive brunt of the burden is going to be borne by people earning over 50 grand, it becomes a more attractive proposition, until you remember that plenty of people earning over 50 grand are also really struggling with the cost of living. 11:48 is the time.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Davy quits BBC over bias scandal. Reform UK has long campaigned to scrap the licence fee. We're joined now by party leader Nigel Farage.
Yeah, I did speak to Donald Trump on Friday, and to say that he was angry would be an understatement. As he said, I thought you guys were allies, and this was a state broadcaster. Absolutely appalling, but it's just the latest of a long list of political biases that we see running throughout the BBC.
You mentioned your conversation with President Trump on Friday. Can you elaborate?
Well, I was just, you know, he was absolutely enraged.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Fishing. It's a wonderful way to spend an afternoon, but it could also be a huge threat to your business. Phishing emails are scams that trick you into giving away vital data, putting your company at risk. So how do you make sure you don't get caught? Hook, line and sinker. Just ask BT.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it. And there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track? We certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Lidl's deluxe mince pies are here. They're buttery, crumbly, Good Housekeeping Institute taste approved and only £1.99 with Lidl Plus. Is there anything more Christmassy? Maybe if they were made in the North Pole? Lidl. More to value. 18 plus GB only, while stocks last, terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 19th of 11th, 2025.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year, every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
You asked, BT answered.
With phishing, awareness makes all the difference. Train your staff to spot suspicious emails and encourage them to slow down. Hackers rely on you being in a rush, so slowing down decreases your risk.
Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Search BT Business Cybersecurity to find out more.
James O'Brien on LBC.
11:51 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where it hasn't gone yet. My anticipation, I'm not making light of anybody's financial struggles. Cost of living crisis is such a sort of unpleasant combination of words, isn't it? Because it really is talking about basics and essentials. If there's a cost of living crisis, then we're in, collectively, we are in all sorts of trouble. And I'll find that pie chart of what your tax money is spent on in a minute. It's always quite arresting. It's always quite interesting. But I haven't lost my sense of anticipation for the budget, because I think we're in politically really interesting times. A furlough, probably a more or a less controversial reminder of why we're in such a hole. The cost of that has to be met. And, of course, the people who benefited from it will also be the people that many outlets will be encouraging to be furious with Rachel Reeves for revealing that the cost of the national economic crisis is even greater than they realised before they got into Downing Street. And I say controversial or uncontroversial because some people still pretend that Brexit wasn't a flipping stupid thing to do, an incredibly stupid thing to do, when all of the economic analysis now points towards things being even worse in the 10-year window than was predicted. The 5-year window they got about right, but the 10-year window probably underestimated. 11:53 is the time. I've got the pie chart, but it's colour-coded, and I've got it in black and white. It is Harry in Sutton Coldfield up next. Harry, what would you like to say?
Hi there, James. Thanks for having me on. Nobody really knows what to expect with this next budget, but of course, the anticipation is that there's going to be more tax rises, that there's going to be a bigger burden placed on working people. In order to meet this hole that nobody really knows, you know, what that hole is, you know, I mean, where's the money being spent? And we seem to get this year after year after year, is that we need more money. And nobody really knows where the money is going.
Are you serious? You're familiar with the old age pension as a concept?
Yes, of course.
The NHS?
Yes.
The army?
Well,
the Navy?
Yeah.
You're familiar with the concept of schools?
Yes, of course.
Long-term care?
Which have all been underfunded.
Long-term care?
Over the last 15 years. Yeah.
Police? You're familiar with the concept of the police?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, we have to pay interest on the debts that we've already got.
Yeah.
Transport? Roads?
Yes, of course.
I'm always slightly impatient when people tell me they don't know what the money is being spent on, Harry. Because I could go on. That's quite a lot of absolutely enormous stuff that the money is spent on, all of which you use or will use at some point in your life.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and that's very true. But how many people...
You can't just gloss over it. Go on, ask me how many people what?
No, not at all. It's what you see, okay, right, is a fair bit of anger, okay, that's going on about, well, you know, we need more money because, you know, we're going to blame asylum seekers, you know, we're going to blame people who are out of work. Most people who complain don't really know where the money's being spent.
No.
But it's not just the money that's being spent, it's where's that money coming from? And time and time again, it's the working person who's constantly being asked, you need to dip into your pockets.
Well, it's about 25% on income tax and about 16% on national insurance. That's 23-24 forecast, so it will have changed a little bit. So it's not quite half. You throw in VAT and the ordinary working person who goes shopping is going to be on the hook for sort of say 40-45%, and then you've got business rates, council taxes, company taxes, non-tax receipts, various other things. But if it's not going to come, I mean, a wealth tax is an interesting concept, mm-hmm. of course, an asset tax, but it's not either or. If you're not going to do the bulk of your tax raising from income, where are you going to get it from?
I think it's something that the government needs to consider, but they keep on getting scared off from it. I mean, I was only watching, I was driving past a billboard earlier where Hickman does a radio station saying that, you know, Reeves has now been asked to reconsider the tax on people leaving the UK. And we don't seem to get the same thing, for tax increases, you know, and national insurance.
They're probably going to cut national insurance. What's your pet subject on where the money should come from instead of from you?
We need to tax people who have the money. Yeah, and you know, just to put a little bit of context on that is that
you've just reminded us that the narrative is, I don't personally buy it, but the narrative is that they're all going to close their businesses and leave the country.
Yeah, but they do this time and time again, James. And the thing is, you're not really going to know the answer to that unless it's done. And sometimes I think you just need to look at what's been happening in this country, especially over the last 10 or 15 years. We started out in 2010 being told, essentially, you normal working people have gone out there and, you know, you've borrowed too much. You know, you've lived, way above your means, therefore you've got to pay for it. They even called it, you know, the credit crunch. And since then, all that we've seen is around 2010, I believe we had something like 50 billionaires in the UK. That number's close to about 200 billionaires in the UK now. There's clearly lots of money, but it's just been channeled upwards. And normal people aren't seeing it.
I don't know how simplistic it is to say that. I don't disagree with you, and I'm not unopposed to the idea. I mean, the far right, super rich are the funniest, because they segue effortlessly from telling lies about Sharia law in this country to claiming that they want to move to countries, or that they have moved in some cases to countries that have got Sharia law, because they are so perturbed by having to pay tax. I most of the really detailed research that I've seen doesn't posit a wealth tax as a solution to the problems that we're talking about. At the very best, it's a contributor. And income tax rises would be another contributor. I don't think one does away with the need for the other. I really don't. But just by way of illustration, that pie chart breaks down like this. 18.3% health. This is where your tax money goes. 18.3% of what you pay in income tax goes on health. 12.2% goes to the old age pension. And I don't know how well this goes down. It's not a subject I return to very often, but how much of that is going to people who really, really don't need it? 10.2% social security to working age people and children, so that will include all universal credit and PIP and the like. So 10% roughly of the entire national expenditure. Just under that on education. 8.4% servicing the debt that we've got. 4.8% on defence. 3.8% on transport. And 3.8% on public order. So I you were looking to trim that particular joint of meat. I don't know where you'd start, really. The most obvious place to start, and this isn't my suggestion, this is just me observing, would be pensioners. Who looks at the NHS service and thinks that needs less money? Or income tax, with a little side order of Harry's wealth tax. Could live with all of that. But when it happens, the question of what we're going to look at to decide whether or not it has worked is probably going to involve all of those things. We will expect all of those things to improve, up to, for some voters, and including, the size of the old age pension itself. It's 12 noon.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the outgoing chief executive of BBC News says she stands by the journalism of staff at the organisation. Deborah Turnis is stepping down with Director General Tim Davey because of criticism about a programme on Donald Trump.
Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
They're accused of editing the US president's speech on the night of the Capitol riots in a way that misled viewers. Leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, has told LBC he's not surprised.
I did speak to Donald Trump on Friday, and to say that he was angry would be an understatement. As he said, I thought you guys were allies. And this was a state broadcaster. Absolutely appalling, but it's just the latest of a long list of political biases that we see running throughout the BBC.
The BBC's chairman is expected to apologise later. A 34-year-old woman has died in hospital after being stabbed in Birmingham. She was attacked on Friday night, and a 21-year-old has been arrested. LBC's Isaac Johnson is in Birmingham.
This happened just before 9 p.m. in a very busy part of the city, right outside the Bullring shopping centre and opposite Birmingham New Street station. Jason Raphael, who's 21 and described as a black British national, was charged with attempted murder over the weekend, as well as two further assaults and possession of a blade. In a statement, West Midlands Police say following the victim's death, an application will be made to amend the charges to reflect the change in the victim's condition.
New centres are being set up across the country to help veterans with things like healthcare and housing. Government funding is being put aside, with more money for service people at risk of homelessness. The founder of Checkatrade has given his backing to Nigel Farage and Reform UK. The leader of the party has been giving a speech at a press conference in London. Kevin Burns says he doesn't see a vision for the country outside of reform. And Ofsted says its new colour-coded report card system will be better for parents. Schools across England will now be graded with more detail instead of a single word outcome. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 90 points at 97.73. The pound buys $1.32 and a euro 14. LBC weather, scattered showers for most of England and Wales this afternoon. They could be heavier in Scotland, feeling mild with highs of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Lottie Morley.
For anyone needing assistance when travelling with TfL, such as people with visual or mobility impairments, our Turn Up and Go service has staff on hand to help. It's available at all London Underground, London Overground and Elizabeth Line stations, and there's no need to book. Just turn up and go. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
I think Catherine in Warrington is going to inspire the next hour of the programme. Two children. Well, it was a fascinating call, wasn't it? One in the military. Her daughter left school at 16, joined the military. She's 21 now, serving king and country. And a son who went to work in a supermarket, tired of the rigmarole, quite understandably. Because if you're on that sort of wage, it doesn't really instill in you any belief that it can lead anywhere else. I choose my words quite carefully here because I've been out of that age group for even longer than you might think from my appearance. And also because I don't have any lived experience of it. But you look at the numbers, particularly the explosion in house prices, which has not been in any way tracked by increases in wages. And you ask somebody to go to work for the National Living Wage in retail, and they ask you why, you can't say the things that you used to be able to say. You can't say, well, if you get your head down and work hard, then you'll be able to do this and do that and get this and get that. I just don't think that works anymore. And some people will always be on that wage or thereabouts. And the existence of ladders, increasingly rare ladders, but ladders upon which you can climb to higher incomes, does not change the fact that some people will always be on the lower rungs. And it is the aspirations of the lower rungs that I think constitute the biggest socioeconomic story of our time, because I used to sit here in a state of some befuddlement about what was happening in this category. We're talking about people aged from 16 to 24 who aren't doing anything, because that is where Catherine's other child is now. He is trying to make a living on TikTok. And I imagine, and in fact I think this is what she said as a consequence of me pointing out the existence of these people, of the almost a million 16 to 24-year-olds not in education, employment or training, I think the biggest insight I've had in this world is into the existence of young people who aren't doing anything because they've not really changed since school. So you are sleeping in the same bed, in the same bedroom, and wearing the same clothes, not uniform, obviously, that would be weird, and getting up to eat the same food and then kicking your heels all day, spending time online or maybe doing something slightly more constructive but unpaid, or trying to scrape a few quid together by trading online or by trying to get paid for the content that you're making on social media, or doing, you know, completely different things. But I think as a parent, this is the key insight that, what do you do? I'm giving up my job I'm giving up my minimum wage job in Tesco because it's not leading anywhere. How do you argue with that child? I'm never going to be able to afford it. I'm going to stay at home. And as a parent, you want to wrap your arms around these people, right? You know your son and your daughter better than I ever will. I know my daughters better than you ever will. We're not in this zone. We're in the age range, but both of mine are still in education. But if they weren't, some of it will be health-related, the impact of long COVID in particular, and COVID itself on both physical and mental health remains criminally undermeasured and underreported. So you will not be able to understand the existence of these people without understanding the impact upon mental and physical health. But even then, the number of 16 to 34-year-olds with a mental health condition who are economically inactive due to long-term sickness has rocketed in the 5 years since 2019, but it still stands at just about a fifth of the overall total. So that is not the answer to the question. If there was nobody in this country aged between, that's 16 to 34, I think, not 16 to 24, unless it's a typo in the newspaper I'm reading. That is not, if there were none in that category, we would still be talking about a crisis. So if there was no 16 to 24-year-old off work due to long-term sickness, economically inactive due to long-term sickness, we would still be talking about a national crisis. We'd still be talking about 750,000 people or thereabouts, as opposed to 1 million. Alan Milburn, former health secretary, is charged with exploring this, examining leading a new review into the rising inactivity among Britain's young people. And I mentioned to you in the last hour that the subjects I'm beginning to enjoy the most are the ones that don't have neat answers. It's funny. I guess I'd probably get bored of my job, God forbid, if I didn't constantly find my attitude to it changing. The things I used to find most enjoyable, I no longer do. What's that line from Shakespeare? With what I most enjoy contented least. With what I most enjoy contented least. It's from my favourite sonnet. I get more excited now by things that I didn't used to think were interesting, and less excited by things that I used to find fascinating. And the shorthand for that is that I really like the subjects that don't have easy answers. They're probably the subjects that lend themselves most obviously to big reviews by former heavy hitters in government to actually find out what the answers are. It's almost like the anathema of being a radio phone-in host, traditionally. What do you mean you don't like simple answers? I don't like simple answers. Well, why are you working as a radio phone-in host then?
I don't think you've listened to my programme.
But historically, that's what you do. You know, how do you feel about income tax? Asylum seekers? How do you feel about Brexit? Oh, derangement syndrome. You're supposed to just have meaningless, pithy, little throwaway lines. Fig leaves, I often think of in this context. A fig leaf to cover up your ignorance on any subject under the sun, whatever it is. Here's a fig leaf that's been forged for you by tabloid sensibilities, and it frees you from the responsibility of thinking about things. So why are there so many young people economically inactive? Oh, they're lazy. And also lying. That's it. Next question. They're lazy and they're lying. So I used to think you could find the positive equivalent of the negative simplistic answers, but you can't. There'll be so many parents listening to this programme now about whose children we are talking. It's why Catherine Lynn Warrington is the inspiration for this conversation, because she was expounding a perfectly feasible position on her own income tax going up when so many young people are not doing anything in the workplace. And then it emerged that her own son is one of them. He is trying to make a living on TikTok, which qualifies him as a member of the NEETs, the Not in Education, Employment or Training. If he's one of the lucky few who manages to make a decent crust creating online content, then God bless and good luck. But it ain't going to work for most people any more than being a professional footballer or a pop star was for previous generations. And that question there of why? Why is inactivity rising at such a rate of knots? Why? And I'll take any answer you've got specific to your own life, if you want. I mean, the phone-in I've never really got off the ground. And probably because it is so obviously a question that invites so many different answers that it ends up being a sort of victim of its own size. You don't know where to start nibbling at this. But why is your son not
in education, employment or training? Why is your daughter? And if you do it like that, you are unlikely to get a long queue of people explaining that they're all lazy or liars or both. That's the trick, you see. Ask those people over there why so many young people are inactive. Why so many 16 to 24-year-olds are not in education, employment or training. And they'll tell you that they used to struggle to work in hobnailed boots and young people today don't know they're born and everything was better in the good old days. Ask a parent why their own child is currently not in education, employment or training. And you will probably get rather different and much more helpful answers. But you won't get easy throwaway answers like you'd get if you asked people who don't have personal investment in this issue what is going on, in which case you get the very neat fig leaf. Oh, they're all lazy or liars or both. That's not true, is it? It simply can't be true. Nearly a million people aged 16 to 24 are not in education, employment or training. Phone in question, why? 0345 6060 973, or rather, why not? Why? And when I tell you that the long-term sickness quota or portion of that population is 190,000, a massive rise since 2019. It's gone up by about three quarters, so it's almost doubled. But it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't answer the question. I believe, for the record, that the massive majority of those cases will be good faith, will be people who would much, much rather not be signed off sick. I really do, particularly because it is part of our population that needs a lot more support than people who are obviously and physically ill, particularly those with mental health conditions. The exacerbation of things like anxiety and depression and the like by month upon month of enforced isolation it is criminally undermeasured and underreported and underappreciated. So this isn't really a question that admits the answer from honest people. They're all swinging the lead. But even if they were, the numbers would still be huge. We would still be talking about three quarters of a million 16 to 24-year-olds rather than nearly a million 16 to 24-year-olds. So that's not the answer, albeit that it's a very helpful scapegoat for the furiously hard of thinking and their cheerleaders in the media. We've had reviews, we've had reports, we've had white papers. Conservatives commissioned them, Labour governments commissioned them. Nobody has managed to arrest the increase, to stop the growth. Rachel Reeves in the budget is going to offer guaranteed paid work to every eligible young person who has been on universal credit for 18 months without earning or learning. But that posits free choice. That means that in her mind, these people are choosing not to engage with the workplace, but would do if the enticements were greater. I don't know that that's real. You've been offered a minimum wage job in a supermarket and you've started it and you hate it. And you can't do what we all did growing up, which is console ourselves with the knowledge that it will lead somewhere. Console ourselves with the knowledge that there might be a promotion around the corner, or we'll be able to start saving for the deposit for a house or a flat. I don't know. I'm thinking out loud because, as I say, it's quite still, thankfully, there are no guarantees in life, but thankfully this is not a phenomenon that impacts directly upon my own family at this point in our lives. But if it did, would I ring in? Why is your daughter not in education, employment or training? And it's not for medical reasons. Well, what is it then? Hit the numbers now, you will get through. I'm not in any way, I mean, you know I'm not, but just for the record, in case you've just tuned in, I'm not diluting or denying the prevalence and reality of medical conditions, but it's not the answer to this question for three quarters of the people we're talking about. It's not the answer to this question. So why is your 16 to 24-year-old not in education, employment or training if it's not for medical reasons? We've done medical reasons and we'll do them again. But today, I want to zone in on this. How do you explain it? And I think you probably need to be the parent of one of these people to have an even vaguely useful insight, don't you? Because the rest of us are going to be very, very easily tempted into the youth of today paradigm. Oh, the youth of today, they don't know they're born. Or a fat dose of in my day-itis. Oh, in my day, everything was better. We worked harder. But if you're a parent, if you're looking at your child and you're struggling to make the arguments that our parents made when we were feeling a little bit sorry for ourselves, or we explained that we wanted to hang up our tape measures if, like me, you were working in retail. I mean, the rewards were good, man. I think I had more kind of ready cash in my pocket when I was working in River Island by day and in a local restaurant in Kidderminster by night. Of course, the living was much lower. My money went much further. Is that it? Is it just the idea of what you earn doesn't touch the sides of what you would need to change your life, so you choose not to change your life? You stay in the same bed, in the same bedroom, in the same house with the same people, eating the same meals and wearing the same clothes and leading the same life that you led when you were in full-time education, except you're just not going to school anymore. Nothing else has changed. You will amuse yourself between 9 a.m. and 3:30 in ways when it used to be the responsibility of the school to keep you. I don't know. But I do know this. They're not swinging the lead. They're not taking the mickey. And they are almost certainly more sinned against than sinning. So why is the 16 to 24-year-old in your house, in your life, or in your family, currently not in education, employment, or training? And remember, for the purposes of this conversation today, it's not for medical reasons. It's 12:19.
LBC.
In 2024, a hangry fan posted, "Why do other countries have better McDonald's menus than ours?" So, we went abroad and heisted some worldwide favourites. The World Menu Heist. 9 of the most wanted McDonald's menu items from around the world. Now in the UK. Until 25th of November from 11 a.m. Fees apply to delivery orders. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
Now, let me ask y'all a question. Are you ready to ditch the crowds and the cookie-cutter holidays? I'm talking quiet mornings spent by crystal clear lakes, cruising across the vast landscapes of Canada and the U.S. at a leisurely pace, stopping at charming towns and saying howdy. Go deeper with littleamerica.co.uk.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 12 is the time, and I think it is, I've said this to you before, and I will almost certainly say it again, I think it is the biggest question of our time. Why are so many 16 to 24-year-olds not doing any of the things that 16 to 24-year-olds have historically always done? Most obviously, education, employment or training. What do they do all day? Because we're getting another inquiry into it, another review, this one led by the former Health Secretary, Alan Milburn. What we do know is that it ain't down to sickness. It ain't down to being signed off sick for the massive, massive majority of them. So that ship has sailed. What on earth is left? Let's go to Nick, who's in Nairn. Nick, what would you like to say?
When I first moved to Scotland in 2005, I relocated up onto Shetland, the Port of Croft, and I've been looking for work, and I ended up working on a neat project. Now, at the time, we had the joys of not Brexit, and the funding that we got was from the European Union, recognising that if people are neat for more than 7 years, yeah, they'll probably never work again.
Wow.
Now, I got onto that process. I was a mentor. That's the sort of work I do. I won't get into that, talking about me, but long and short, that's my skill set.
Okay, you can talk about yourself as much as you want. I mean, crikey, if I've not established anything on this show over the years, surely I've established that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so imagine I arrive on this scheme. I understand that we've got X amount of funding, and there was a lot of practice. Now, one of the things that we learned very quickly was to get these young people out of the job centre. And you'd say to me, why was that? Because what they wanted to do was to shoehorn people into what they called at the time survival employment. Now, what I discovered, and it's in a nutshell for you, my friend, is that most of these people were extremely capable people who thought and perhaps were more creative, had a different way of thinking. I'm not talking about any learning, but I'm talking about, you know, far rich, you know, people in the sense of their view of the world and complex. And they were being shoehorned in, and they literally had the stuffing knocked out of them. And they just disengaged and were fed up with the idea that they only do this, and they were rudderless. Now, we used to pay them £50 a week at the time. I'd go and collect them. I used to run into Lerwick because I lived out in the districts, and I'd pick two or three of the people as I came into Lerwick, into our centre. And the conversations we had were about finding out what would reignite these people, but it was on a one-to-one basis, not this global attitude that, well, you just need to do this.
One size fits all.
Now, I'm still in touch with some of these people. I mean, one of the people that, you know, works on the ferries from Shetland to the mainland, and he's married, he's got a couple of kids, and he's as happy as Larry. When I first met him, he was actually in the doldrums. And, you know, but long and short is what I'm trying to say is...
The system used to help.
Well, it was a model of practice brought to Scotland from the European Union as a massive study. Now, this is back in 2005. And that project was funded by the European Union, and my wages and all the little tricks and things that we did was disengaging them from shoehorning them to employment. All this stuff has been done. And, you know, it worked. It's a very, very good model of practice. It's recognising people. And strange enough, in my own journey, in my life, I was the kid that always said, why? And they said, never mind.
It's quite a different world from 2005. I know you stay close to some of these factors, but something big has changed in the ensuing 20 years to make everything move faster and this problem get much, much bigger. So I don't think it is necessarily going to be down to square pegs in round holes anymore. There's going to be something existential that's shifted, isn't there?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. But what I'm trying to say is that these people were not feckless. Their parents weren't feckless.
No.
That's
probably the most important brick to lay in the foundations of anything that we build up by way of an answer to this question. Because, again, as with almost every lazy right-wing tabloid solution to a problem, it's the wrong solution to the wrong problem. They are not feckless. And if they're signing off sick, they are not lying in the massive majority of cases. There's something changing. There's so many different types of NEET as well. There'll be the people who... we're expecting to be working by now and are even more shocked than we are that they're not. And there'll be the people who've tried and decided it's not for them. There'll be the people who don't see the point. I mean, there are so many answers to this question, which is why I'm asking it in the way that I'm asking it. Why? Why is the NEET, so-called NEET in your life, not currently doing anything? Or if you are one of them, why are you not currently in education, employment or training? Talk me through the process, the journey to the place where you currently are, because I suspect you'd rather not be there. Keir is in Newham. Keir, what would you like to say?
Yeah, hi. I'm just calling as someone who... I'm 22 and I just graduated from law in the summer.
Okay.
And I'm currently enjoying a job seeker's allowance from Universal Credit, but I think you described it quite well, is that I thought when I graduated, I didn't think I would still be here at this point now. And I'm calling you actually this Monday, as I normally wake up, maybe I'll go to the gym, and then I'll start job searching.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that since the end of the summer, and I haven't even got so much as an interview. And it's genuinely quite demoralizing, to be honest, because I thought I graduated with a first class law degree, And I thought my case is a little bit unique because halfway through the degree, I used to do, I think similar to you, used to do a bit of creative performing arts. And I started to miss it. So I thought, while I have, while I feel like I have the freedom and time to get a job that will be flexible enough to allow me to pursue that creative passion. But I always thought that, well, I'll have a law degree. So that's quite a good thing to fall back on. That's what the understanding was.
Sure.
And I remember that, like, a month ago, there was 1 week where every day I would check my emails and I would have a different rejection from a different employer that I'd applied to in the previous week. And it's crazy that I have a degree. The story that everybody tells you growing up is that you go to school, you get your A-level, you go and get a degree, and then you'll be able to get a job. So it is just kind of baffling that me and a lot of my friends as well have degrees, but that nothing's happening with it. We're not able to actually get a job.
Well, when do you think? And I hesitate. I don't really want you to think about this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. When do you think that getting any job becomes the order of the day, rather than hanging in there for the job you're qualified to do and the job you've worked very hard at college to do? Because that is the question that pops into my mind from a place of enormous sympathy. So I was selling suits, trying to get into journalism. So I wasn't signing on, as you are, but I certainly hadn't left university intending to work in retail. But after 2.5 years of failing to set any journalistic fires blazing, I was beginning to think, well, that's it then. That's not going to happen for me. So I looked at what opportunities were available in that company and starting climbing up. So when do you stop dreaming of the law? And I don't want you to. This is a theoretical question, Keir. And recognise that you're going to have to get some sort of job, full stop.
Yeah, it is a good point. And that's sort of what you're describing is sort of the looming sort of anxiety. I know that there's that I sort of can't go on like this forever.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking now with Christmas coming up, I will definitely need some more money in my pocket than I currently have. So I'm thinking in the next couple of weeks to start looking at temporary Christmas jobs, and then during this part time, I'm quite lucky in that I'm able to live at home.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, in terms of meals, accommodation, even perhaps a bit of pocket money in addition to what you're getting on Job Seekers, you're being looked after by parents.
Yeah, my mum's very, very supportive, but that's honestly a privilege.
I get that, and you're right, and I agree, and I would be the same when I was your age, although there's probably fewer opportunities in Kidderminster than there are in London in the southeast. But you have to get some income over the course of the Christmas period. There will hopefully be seasonal work around. Is there a point upon which you think, right, the law's not going to happen? Well, I don't want to ask you this. You know I don't. But is there a point at which you think, right, the law's clearly not going to happen? I'm going to have a rethink.
Well, I think that I'm probably not at that point yet, but it will be that it is at the back of my mind. I don't know. I couldn't give you a...
No, I don't want you to. But of course you can't. I mean, you could be working now, doing something in the service sector for cash, for money, for the moolah. But you don't need to because your mum's got that covered and your lifestyle sounds above bearable, nicer than bearable. But you can't be completely available for other sorts of work if you are aiming for a profession like that. It's a funny old paradox to be caught in. But you clearly want to work as a lawyer. You're not going to fit into any of the categories. You're not faking an illness, you're not lazy, you're not feckless, but you are in neither education, employment, nor training. And I don't know what Alan Milburn would do with a case like yours, Keir, but I hope you find something that you want to do sooner rather than later. I really do, as would almost everybody listening. Tim Humphrey is here now with your headline.
The former head of BBC News insists her staff are not corrupt after resigning over an edit of one of Donald Trump's speeches. Deborah Tenness stepped down from the corporation alongside Director General Tim Davey yesterday. A woman has died after being stabbed in the neck near New Street Station in Birmingham on Friday. 21-year-old Dejon Raphael has been charged in relation to the attack and will appear in court today. The education regulator Ofsted says the new report card inspection system in England will raise standards for all children. The changes come after head teacher Ruth Perry took her own life following a poor rating in 2023. Head teachers say they should have been consulted on the changes. LBC weather, rain and showers moving northeast, bright spells in between, mild in the south but windy with a high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Julie could part exchange her car. Or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging. Or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Or total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute, meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan, and Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC with James O'Brien. Text 84850.
It's 12:34. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Here's the question, right? If they're not all lazy, scrounging, layabouts, malingering and faking illnesses, and listen, if it means so much to you, you can believe that some of them are, if you want. Even you can believe a significant number of them are, if it helps. But it's still not going to touch the sides of almost a million 16 to 24-year-olds being in neither education, employment, nor training. So what are they doing? And who are they? And what explains the presence of the young person in your life in this category? Or like Keir, our last caller, if you're one of them, how have you ended up in this category? Given that for our generation, it's really hard to understand. Although this from Philip, I think is probably an overlooked element. And it plays in with my latest theory about the leaving school but not leaving school mindset. I believe, writes Philip, that a huge number are just not bored enough. There's too much to occupy their minds at home. 24-hour TV on demand, gaming, social media. It's so easy to get hooked on sitting around, and you don't need much then. I don't know. I mean, I think there's something in that. Think about adults scrolling, playing. When's the last time you were, like, summer holidays bored? Speaking to what age now? Over 40s? Over 35s? What age do you have to be to know what boredom is? Like, real. Even car journey boredom doesn't count anymore because you'll be playing on a device in the back of the car, right? Car journey boredom. Are we nearly there yet? Are we nearly there yet? Car journey boredom. Songs of praise on the telly boredom. Sunday boredom. Summer holidays, boredom. Shops shut, nothing on the telly, only three channels anyway, boredom. Boredom. And I read a lot of books, don't get me wrong. Playing tennis against a wall for hours on end, pretending to be on board, boredom. What age do you have to be to understand that boredom, because for a 16 to 24 year old now, we are describing an entirely alien existence. I'm bored, Mum. Mum, I'm so bored. I'm bored. What if they're just not bored enough to go out and do something less boring instead? Special points if you can remember what television programme that was part of the theme song for. Go out and do something less boring instead. You won't know, you're too young. Sorry, I'm having a private conversation with the producer at the moment. So why? That's one theory, and there will be a million theories. There's probably as many theories, there's probably as many answers to this as there are people in the catchment area. Tufail is in Bexley Heath. Tufail, what made you pick up the phone?
Oh, hi, James. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Must say, you are my favourite presenter, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I'm just driving to work. I'm pulled over now. And then when the question came up, I just thought to myself, actually, there is quite a lot of people, especially like my son, who's 18 years old. He's just finished his A-levels. He achieved straight A's, got all the grades he could do. He set a UCAT exam. He came in the 9th decile, which I believe is like top 5, top 10% in the country. Mm. He's done everything he can possibly do to get into study dentistry. But out of all the universities he applied for, he didn't even get an interview in a single university. So then he tried to get in through clearing. There was no places available through clearing. And he still wants to study dentistry. So instead of going into work, he's been trying to contact dentist surgeries across the local area, writing them letters, going to see them to ask if he could do some voluntary work just to get some experience so that he could help his application for next year. So he's technically not training, he's technically not working, and he's technically not in education, but it's not because he's lazy, it's because he's trying to do absolutely everything he can to go do what he wants and become something that he wants to be, but the system just isn't set up to be able to support him.
I had no idea about this, and it's not Mystery Hour, so I'm allowed to Google things while you're talking, and it is a thing, it's a well-established thing, and it's that old chestnut about it's not enough to have brilliant A-level results and a strong UCAT result, you also need significant relevant experience. And you're sort of like, hang on a minute, I'm 18, I've just been working on my A-levels. How many teeth am I supposed to have pulled over the course of the last 6 months?
Absolutely, yeah.
And you presumably don't have any family friends who are dentists or anything like that who could have helped out.
Well, if I did, that would make life so much easier.
Yeah,
it's interesting. The responses he's had from a couple of dentist surgeries has been the fact that actually they would love to, but it would mean that they would have to take out additional insurance.
Right.
For him to be there. So it's an addition, even though he wants to volunteer himself, it's an added cost for the business.
It's a mad old business.
They would need.
Because we've got huge numbers of people. There's a story in the news today, appropriately enough, Tufail, about the number of kids whose teeth are like graveyards. Absolutely rotten teeth, because it's so hard to get an NHS dentist. Many parents aren't even bothering. And we're probably eating more sugar than ever before. So the idea that there is a low number of places and a high demand among people like yours, it doesn't make any objective sense from the outside, does it? But here we are. What you describe is not unique to your boy, as you will know. He needs a compelling personal statement and a strong performance in interviews.
Absolutely.
And he needs significant relevant experience. So he gets it, and he's going to spend his year off, presumably, I sense, from having just met his dad, that he might have to earn a crust as well if he's not going to be doing anything. He might have to get some paid work as well if he can't get the paid dentistry work.
Yeah, he's applying for some Christmas temp vacancies just to try and see if he can get something. But he's also reached out to, I think, the job seeker, so just to see if he can get something for this year while he's trying to find work. But it's not because he's lazy and it's not because he doesn't want to find work, but it's just because the system isn't there to support him. Because actually, technically, what he'd really like to be doing is he'd be able to do some volunteer work, volunteering in whether it's in hospitals, dental surgery, wherever, just so that he could get the experience he needs to be able to do the course. So if the government said, hey, listen, we won't even give you job seekers, but we've got a system where we will cover the liability insurance for any surgery that takes you on.
That's all you want.
That would help.
And he's still
not available.
Nassim puts it well. He says, your boy's still pushing. How do you get to someone who isn't pushing? How do you get someone who isn't pushing to push? I don't know. It's a different conversation, which we'll probably have before 1 o'clock. But for your son, I mean, it's not like he's dreaming of being on top of the pops, is it? Or playing for Arsenal. He wants to be a dentist. And the system is rigged against him as it stands. And there's someone else in the category of 16 to 24-year-olds not currently in education, employment or training. You see what I mean? About how it is really not going to be one of those questions that is answered by neat and pithy tabloid tropes. I wish him luck, Tufel. I really do. And if we get any interesting advice or input from listeners over what he may do next, then I will. I promise we will pass it on to you. 12:42 is the time. Why have you handed me this? Brushing. People don't brush their teeth enough either. That's another reason. You've got to... Because it's really... Oh, OK, that is interesting. So brushing teeth is boring. Dr. Zand says so. You know him. He says you've got to focus on the sensation of the bristles and approach toothbrushing mindfully, not scrolling on your phone at the same time. So, I mean, everything is about boredom. Boredom, boredom, boredom. God, you know that favourite jingle of all time, don't you? From a man who I've had the absolute pleasure of meeting subsequently as a consequence of him tuning into this old nonsense. I used to tune into him on Beacon Radio in Wolverhampton when I was 10, 11 years old. I think I made my radio debut on his weekend breakfast show telling a joke. But do you know what I did? I didn't turn my radio off. And they told me to as well, but I thought, well, I'm recording it. I'm not going to turn my radio off. I'm recording it so I can play it back to Mum and Dad later when they get up. And he had the finest radio jingle of all time. He heard me mention it on this show and sent it to me. I've got it somewhere on a what are they called? Not a JPEG, whatever, an audio file. Gordon Astley is the legend of whom I speak, and the jingle went like this. Gordon, Gordon, drives away your boredom. If you wake up feeling ghastly, tune in to Gordon Astley. Absolutely fantastic. I can't remember why I went down that particular avenue of conversation. Was it something to do with being bored? Oh, boredom. Drives away your boredom. There you go. Boredom. Wouldn't work in a jingle now. You play it now. Gordon, Gordon, drives away your boredom. And all the kids would go, what's boredom, Mum? What's boredom, Mum? I'm on level 14 of Baldur's Gate 3. What's boredom? What's boredom, Mum? But we knew what it was back in the day, and it seems I wasn't the only one who watched Why Don't You? Matthew's in Telford. Matthew, what made you pick up the phone?
It's really about my sister, really. My half-sister. She's 21 now, and she's never had a job, never had any interest in putting together a CV, never any motivation or any encouragement from anybody about getting a job. And it's just all... And she's still the same now. She's always just in the same house that she was born in.
Yeah.
She's just no interest at all in ever having a job or in making her own money.
Why not?
That's the question that I don't really know.
Well, that's no good. What have you rung in for? You've just rung in to slag off your sister. I want answers and solutions. No, I'm joking.
No, I know, exactly. No, it's like, you know, she's got nothing wrong with her. She's been tested for, like, autism and everything like that, and she's got nothing wrong with her, but she doesn't speak to anybody. And it's the same thing at school. So I'm not sure if it's something that she's grown up with and she's not talked to anybody.
She doesn't necessarily sound like she's enjoying this existence, Matthew. Or not?
No, it doesn't at all.
Okay.
I mean,
In that case, I'm sorry. You're not slagging her off. You're expressing concern for her.
No, I'm expressing concern really because you know I love my sister. I want her to be able to succeed, and that she doesn't. She's every time I mention it to her, she just like hides in a corner and doesn't want to discuss it.
Well, she has got mental health issues, then, even if they haven't been diagnosed. Does she get very anxious?
Possibly. Yeah. It's just really sad, really, because she's. She doesn't know what she wants to do. She hasn't got any interest in looking what she wants to do or finding anything to help her, you know, anything like that. So,
and what about, I don't want to get into a kind of Oprah Winfrey style scenario, but I mean, what about parents? Why aren't they doing something a bit different from what they are doing?
Same question, really. I mean, same thing for me, really. Same question. It's like my mom's not really encouraging her. My stepdad's not encouraging her. They're doing everything, you know, they're just, she's just living there, like you said earlier on, she can go to the fridge whenever she wants and eats what she wants, she can...
And she's not living the life of Riley, she's living in a form of limbo, right? She's in almost a stagnant existence, everything's on pause, but we've got no idea when anyone's going to press play again, and it's not going to be her that does it, she's going to need some sort of outside intervention, it's not going to come from Mum.
No.
Where on earth is it going to come from? And if you said to her, I need you at work at 10 o'clock tomorrow, she'd probably have a panic attack of some sort.
Yeah, probably.
It's
so sad and upsetting that there's nothing out there to help these kind of people.
Yeah, well...
Through it.
And now, I mean, Rachel Reeves is going to announce funding a youth guarantee, guaranteed paid work for people like your sister if she's on Universal Credit. If she's not, if Mum's picking up all the bills, then that's another crack that she will slip through. But if you can't get out of the house because you haven't done it for so long, you don't want to be living this life. That's the start from there. These young people do not want to be living the existences that they're living. Some do. Catherine's boy, who left Tesco to do TikTok. I bet he's furious with her now. Hopefully he's not listening, and no one he knows is either. But that there will be some people making a choice. I understand the choice, but there'll be some people who don't have any choice whatsoever in their current situation. And the idea that you can get a one-size-fits-all answer to these questions is, I mean, it's a little bit daft, isn't it? Matthew, take care. It is 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Dodgy edits, a furious US president, a critical internal report revealing bias on issues from Gaza to women's rights. Do you still want to pay for the BBC?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walker's. Delicious.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Great to see you back at Specsavers. Okay, could you read out the letters on the wall for me?
Yep. D-E-A-L-S? Yeah, D-E-A-L-S. Deals.
Oh, right. Our Black Friday deals are eye-catching, but the letter chart's over here.
Oh, sorry.
At Specsavers, we've got all sorts of unmissable Black Friday deals, like up to £50 off one pair of designer glasses. Offer ends on 7th of December 2025. Conditions apply. Ask in store for details.
It's easy to forget just how crazy things have been over the past couple of years. Every day we wake up to something new. Tariffs and taxes on anything and everything. It's tempting to put your hands in your ears and go, la 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 la, I can't hear you, until it's all over. But you know what's the best response to crazy times? A plan for your money. And Quilter can help. Because let's face it, there's probably going to be some crazy times ahead too. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad! Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down, not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It is 10 minutes to 1, and Chris managed to put a smile on my face somewhat unexpectedly. He writes, I'm struggling to find a dentist at the moment. I'll be happy to let Tufel's lad pull out 3 of my teeth just to help him get the relevant experience. I've had quite a few messages like that. This is not something I can get involved in. If you want to make private arrangements to have unregulated and uninsured dental work, then that's your lookout. It's absolutely not something that LBC can be associated with, so stop trying to tempt me into trouble. Although, if you are still listening to Fel, and frankly, why wouldn't you be, then I'm told by Tom, who is a NHS doctor in Swansea, that the maxillofacial departments in hospitals may be able to help. They'll have all the relevant insurance and may well be looking to provide work placements. Again, Tom's clearly texting in good faith, but I can make no contribution beyond what I have just done. But I think a lot of people listening felt not just your fatherly concern in that call, but also your boy's plight. You know, the idea, as with Keir, getting his first-class degree in law and not being able to get arrested, pardon the pun, by any law firms. So there is a sort of breach of trust, I think, generationally speaking. And whether you want to chalk it up to the political argument that too many people go to university, which right-wing politicians often say about children who aren't theirs. You'll never meet a right-wing politician who argues that their own children shouldn't have gone to university. It's always your children that shouldn't have gone to university. Someone else's children who shouldn't have gone to university. We're sending too many children to university. What's your 22-year-old doing at the moment? Oh, he's just finishing at university. Oh, So who are the children that we are sending to university that we shouldn't be? Poor people. Poor people, and of course, if you're a racist, people who don't look like me. Too many of them at university. Yeah, absolutely certain of it. I was reading about, who was I reading about the other day? Someone who's got a passing interest in eugenics. And you read his sort of CV and backstory, and you thought, flipping heck, mate. For somebody who's been handed 463 silver spoons at their own christening, to think that the reason why you've ended up with a stately home and a gilded existence is because of eugenics, some sort of innate biological superiority that you have over people, then I've got a bridge that you might like to buy. Craig's in Herne Bay to steer us back to neats. Craig, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Nice to talk to you again.
Likewise.
Big fan of the show.
Thank you.
This is the kind of error that really annoys me. I'll explain a bit more. It's just that there's a lack of empathy for this age group, I think, in society.
I agree.
I work with children in care up to 16 to 18 years old, and my son's 17. And I sometimes have to remember back when I was 17 years old, which was a while ago now, in the 90s. Yeah. There was so many opportunities for me, work-wise, career-wise, education-wise. I had three part-time jobs when I left school, and it was literally a case of local supermarket, local newsagent, and a warehouse. That's not there for children these days anymore.
I know a 17-year-old who is so desperate to find some part-time paid work that he went back and asked if he could have his paper round back that he had when he was 12. But and actually, not even that funny, there's so few people having a paper delivered now that the newsagent does it himself. He doesn't even employ a schoolboy to do it anymore.
Absolutely. And to me, I find it so lazy when people of my generation say they got it easy, they don't understand what's hard to work. They do want to work. Like, my son is 17, he has autism. We tried to find everything to find him a job because he wants one.
Yeah.
And he must have had two or three rejection emails a day.
That's no fun, is it?
It's no fun. So what we've had to do is he gets personal independent payments and we pay him away. So he volunteers at the local RSPCA centre.
Oh.
And he's not the only one that does that. There are so many people in that age group who will volunteer somewhere just to get a foot on the ladder. I don't know how you can say that's being lazy if you're going to volunteer somewhere to get yourself on the ladder. And people also forget that when I was 17 years old, there was like a societal contract, as in, like, if you work hard, you got a house, you got on in life.
Yeah.
That's not there.
I can't sell that to a 17-year-old now. I can't sell that dream, even if they go and get a degree, come out with a good degree. I can't guarantee any of the things that would once never have been guaranteed, but would have been more likely to happen than not. And you respond to that by deciding that you're not gonna play the game either, and you can't blame them for that necessarily.
And this age group are the ones that are most affected by COVID and the lockdowns. They would have been at schools doing their GCSEs and A-levels. They've had to move to a remote way of learning.
Don't need another review, do you, really? You just need to tackle all the stuff that we already know, collectively that we already know, or indeed act on the findings of the last review. Craig, thank you. Matt makes an interesting point, although it may be coloured slightly by snark. Is there some snark here? He goes, is this all about connections again, James? How did you get into journalism? Is that a bit of snark there, mate? I'll tell you, I sold a white suit to John Major. And then I sold the story to the Daily Express gossip column, and rather than a fee, which is what they offered me, I asked for two shifts instead. And I never looked back. But, obviously, I knew who to call. I got to the Daily Express and knew someone on the news desk because he used to work with my dad. And I had the confidence, or at least the fake public school confidence, to walk into rooms and behave as if I belonged there. So all of the privilege you could possibly imagine. But no, Matt, I didn't get a job in journalism as a consequence of my dad pulling in any favours. I think he might have tried, but all of his colleagues and contemporaries had either died or been made redundant by the time I finally graduated from college. So, you know, fair question. If it wasn't snarky, my apologies. If it was snarky, stick that in your tailpipe and smoke it. Craig, is it? Oh, no, we've done that. Sarah's in Ilford with what will probably be the last word on this, unless you're rubbish, Sarah, in which case I'll bin you off quite early and talk to someone else. What would you like to say?
Hi, James.
Hello.
I'll try not to. I was just basically, this is a subject that's very close to my heart.
Yeah.
I was someone who, sorry, it makes me a little bit emotional actually.
That's okay, take your time.
I feel really bad for young people right now. I know how hard it is. I feel like I was one of the ones that could have been in this position, but I don't know, luck,
yeah,
time, I managed to finally get on the career ladder. but I left uni just as the financial crash happened in 2008.
Right.
I struggled just to get a retail job, just to get any basic job. It took about 2 years after uni. I was depressed on and off throughout, working admin jobs, working, you know, different jobs. And I know how hard it was because I wanted to be a journalist. That was what I'd always wanted to be from the age of like 8 years old. Mm. No one could tell me nothing. I knew what kind of background I was from, like, you know, didn't have much, but I knew I wanted to be a journalist and I couldn't get into it. I couldn't hang on to keep working for free for long enough.
I remember that, actually. I'm obviously older than you, but the, if you had a flat in London or someone you could live with rent-free, then you could do the shifts or you could be available all the time, and it gave a huge advantage to people who were better off.
I lived with my mum, so I didn't even have to pay rent, but I still couldn't afford to keep working for, like, for nothing. And I know what I realised was, like, okay, I have to think of something else, and I tried different career options. Nothing really stuck. You just become really disillusioned. And obviously, I'm working in admin. I didn't want to commit to anything because I knew
you wanted
I had
to
a
be free
plan.
for the. I'm going to run out of time. Do you want to cut to the payoff?
Basically, I think young people now, all I can say to you, don't have a plan B or C. Have a plan D, E, F. Like, have so many other options of what you want to do. Think about other things you want to do and go for it, because the first six things, they're not going to happen, probably, more than likely. There just isn't enough jobs right now.
Yeah, and I mean, that is no longer true of, well, I don't know, I'm probably doing a grave disservice to dentists, because I can't imagine growing up wanting to be a dentist. Like Sarah, I grew up wanting to be a journalist, but that's unfair on dentists. Why wouldn't you grow up dreaming of being a dentist? But it's no longer just the dream jobs. Like, I don't know, I want to be a football player or an actor. It is now almost all the professions as well. It's grim advice, but it is absolutely crucial and speaks directly to this cohort of young people, this entire generation plagued by what they call inactivity. Although, as Craig in Herne Bay reminded us, that's an unhelpful description as well. If you missed any of today's show, and it was a bit special, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on all the top stories and opinions. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, Best Bits from This Show Every Day, and Full Disclosure, which is my long-form interview series. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Swarbrick will be with you at 4 on LBC, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. At 3, I want to return to the subject of homelessness, both for military veterans and anybody else. But I'm going to start with the BBC. Here's what's undisputed. There is a crisis at the BBC, for sure. We've seen those before. What we haven't seen before is a US president agitating against our national broadcaster after one of its most important factual programmes, Panorama, turned an edit into a lie and telling you, the president that is, what to watch instead. That's just one aspect of all of this. There's serious talk of a political coup to bring the whole thing down, but there's also actual editorial problems there and impartiality issues as well, in my humble opinion, which I'll share with you. Would you care if that attempted coup succeeded? I would, but boy, does it need you to trust it.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, BBC Chair Samir Shah says the corporation would like to apologise for that error of judgment over the way Panorama edited speech by President Trump. The BBC's Director General and Chief Executive of News resigned yesterday after the show last year spliced together comments made ahead of the Capitol riots. Deborah Ternes, the former head of News, says staff are not corrupt. Dame Caroline Dynage is Chair of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee.
I think it's really regrettable that Davey had to step down, but I think he was right to do so. I think restoring trust in the corporation's got to come first. And the fact is that they were very slow and they just didn't take it seriously until it was too late.
A man's appeared in court charged with murdering a woman who was stabbed in the neck outside New Street Station in Birmingham on Friday. Dejon Raphael, who's 21 and from Smethwick, is also accused of two counts of causing actual bodily harm and possession of a blade. Another migrant sent to France under the government's one-in, one-out deal has returned to the UK. The Home Office says the individual was detected by biometrics, detained immediately, and will be returned as quickly as possible. Northamptonshire Police Chief Constable Nick Adderley has appeared in court charged with fraud and misconduct in public office after allegedly lying about his military service. The 59-year-old is accused of falsely claiming to be a decorated naval officer and of lying about his educational achievements on his CV. He's been remanded on conditional bail until next month. A new detailed report card inspection system is being launched in England's schools today. Ofsted's changes, which aim to raise standards, come after a head teacher took her own life when her school was downgraded. But the measures have been criticised by unions, saying they remain unsafe. Pepe Delasio is from the Association of School and College Leaders.
Over 75% of our members have said that they think it is worse than the previous set of frameworks and inspection framework that we had. So when we're trying to do something that's better, to end up with something that's worse is not a good position to be in, really.
In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 95 points at 97.77. The pound buys $1.32 and €1.14. The LBC weather, rain and showers moving northeast, bright spells in between, mild in the south but windy, with a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Tim Humphrey.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello, good afternoon to you. Let's talk about the BBC, shall we? And the sort of lens through which I want to talk about it with you is that it matters who our national who leads our national broadcaster. It matters that our national broadcaster gets things as right as it possibly can. And I think, you know, even if you set aside its current very striking and very problematic row with Donald Trump, you know, that is a big problem for it. And I suspect that Donald Trump's interventions here about that Panorama mistake that we've spoken about, you and I spoke about it on Friday, the edit that made it look like Donald Trump had said things that he didn't say and did things that he didn't do. Even if you set that to one side, it matters because it's in pretty much every home and every head in the country. And we talk a lot on this programme, and we'll continue to do so, about social media and its impact on your life, your brain, your mind, your understanding of the world, and your children's brains, minds, understanding of the world and understanding of themselves. That really matters too. But the BBC is an organisation that most people in the country, most adults in the country, pay for. Increasing numbers are not. Streaming services, Netflix and the like, were always going to change and put pressure on the BBC's funding model. That was always going to happen. But a recent internal assessment of its impartiality and whether it has a problem with bias came back and found it wanting. It was an internal report. It's been leaked, so we now know it. This is the Michael Prescott report. And it wasn't just about the Trump edit. It was about the coverage of women's rights as they bump up into trans rights. It was about any number of different issues that the BBC was found wanting on when it came to bias and impartiality. The Israel-Gaza war is a case in point. And arguably, you could look at that in both directions and say it was found wanting sometimes. And this isn't about saying every single report has been found wanting or reporter has been found wanting. I think that would be an unfair thing to say, an untrue thing to say. But I think the reason it matters is because you're obliged to pay for it. If you engage with BBC television, you're obliged to pay for it. It's, you could be, you know, prosecuted for not doing so. That's not true of Netflix. It's not true of other streaming services. So for that reason, it matters, but also because of what it has been and still just about is in our country. It is meant to be, as much as there to entertain, to educate and inform, to use the old sort of Reithian description of what it's for. It's also there partly for cohesion in our country, so that if you're black, white, young, old, gay, straight, left, right, interested in the countryside or interested in urban issues or music or whatever, there is something there for you. And I think, broadly speaking, there is. I think, broadly speaking, there is. So to me, that's why it matters. It matters because it's in your home, it's in your brain, it's in your child's brain, it's in the education system. BBC Education is a massive arm of the BBC. It's in our national discussions, and you and I every day are in conversations about our national issues, aren't we? And for that reason, it matters if it's failing, particularly if its news arm is failing on impartiality. And I think there are some glaring examples where it clearly is. Now, there have been two very high profile resignations over the weekend. As you know, the outgoing BBC News CEO Deborah Turnus has gone, and the Director General Tim Davey has gone. We are told they will serve out their notice, but we'll see how that develops. This was Deborah Turnus speaking on her way into new Broadcasting House, talking to Sky News.
I would like to say it has been the privilege of my career to serve as the CEO of BBC News and to work with our brilliant team of journalists. I stepped down over the weekend because the buck stops with me. But I'd like to make one thing very clear. BBC News is not institutionally biased. That's why it's the world's most trusted news provider.
Why did you fail to deal with the mistakes that were made?
And see my teams. Thank you so much.
Right, we're going in now.
Do you think the journalists are corrupt, President Trotter? Of course our journalists aren't corrupt.
Our journalists are hard-working people who strive for impartiality, and I will stand by their journalism.
Is there institutional bias at the BBC?
There is no institutional bias. Mistakes are made, but there's no institutional bias.
But why weren't the mistakes dealt with on Trump, on anti-Semitism, on women's rights?
I'm sure that story will emerge, but for now, I'm going to go in and see our team.
No mention of the audience, and I will stand by their journalism. Well, only if it's good, Deborah. Stand by it if it's good. But if it's bad, don't stand by it. Speaking to Nick Ferrari at breakfast, this is what Veterans Minister Louise Sander-Jones had to say about the BBC.
It's not for a given minister to opine over that kind of thing. What I would say is it's been clear that there have been editorial failings at the BBC.